Blog Talk Radio.
Brother Kareem?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, he's ready.
All right, I'm dialing the number now.
Well, I hope I don't sneeze.
Yes.
Assalamualaikum, Brother Michael, we're ready.
Waalaikum salam, okay. All right, sis, I'm going to patch you in. We're about to get started in a few moments, okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I may have missed it, Brother Kareem. Are we live now?
Yes, we are okay. Live.
Brother okay. Kareem.
Yes, sir.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. How are you, sir?
Wonderful, by the grace of Allah. Yourself?
I'm fine. All praise due to Allah indeed. Yes, sir. Glad
yes,
to be here and be here, sir.
Wonderful. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. We can hear you just fine.
Okay.
All right. So let me let the listening audience know. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad is his messenger, and we bear witness that the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan is our divine reminder in our midst, and it is my distinct honor, privilege, and pleasure to greet all of you in our greeting words of peace. As-salamu alaykum. And we thank all of you so very much for joining us this morning to hear our international representative of the Nation of Islam, and Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan, Student Minister Abdul Akbar Muhammad, who will be speaking shortly live from Tampa, Florida. And so we want to take this time to thank the study group coordinator, Brother Michael Muhammad, for all his services and for allowing us to join in this program. So if you're listening, Brother Michael, thank you very much.
You are most welcome, dear sister, and thank you for your support and allowing us the opportunity to present this. Brother Akbar is very excited. We're having just a few technical adjustments for the props that we need for his address, so we're just working through those, and with the help of Allah, we will get started. Okay?
Yes, sir. I'll praise to Allah. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Now, how are we? Are we clear? Can you hear us okay?
Yes, sir. I hear you fine.
Okay.
Please stand by. We are awaiting the arrival of Student Minister Akbar Muhammad, who should be speaking in just a few moments. So thank you for your patience. Again, I just want to thank everybody for their patience, and Student Minister Akbar should be joining us shortly, so please stand by. Thank you. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you, dear family, the Honorable Lewis Park, I teach you that all of our needs begin in the spirit blessings of Allah. And so with that said, we'd like to stand, open our meeting, pray. So we ask that you all stand. And if you are unfamiliar with our prayer procedure, that's okay. You can stand in a manner that's most comfortable to you. Those of us who are aware of this process, please assume the position of prayer in the manner that we know how to. Surely I've turned myself to thee, O Allah, trying to be of light to him who originated the heavens and the earth, and I am not from among polytheists. Surely my prayer, my sacrifice, my life and death are all for thee, O Allah, the Lord of all the worlds. No associate has thee, and this is my commandment, and I am of those who submit. O Allah, thou art the king. There is no God but thee. Thou art my Lord, and I am thy servant. I have been greatly unjustified, and do confess my fault. So please grant me protection against all of my faults. For none can grant me protection against falsehood, and guide me into the best of morals. For none can guide me into the best of morals, and turn away from me the evil and the indecent morals. For none can turn away from me the evil and the indecent morals, and all of them. Blessed the true followers of Muhammad, as thou didst bless Abraham, and the true followers of Abraham. And O Allah, make Muhammad successful. Make the true followers of Muhammad successful, as thou didst make Abraham, and the true followers of Abraham successful. For sure, thou art praiseworthy, magnified in thy name. Amen. As you are returning. In the name of Allah, who is the beneficent, the most merciful, we give him praise and thanks for his coming and raising up from amongst us the most honorable Elijah Muhammad. And we thank those too for an extension of grace and mercy in this dispensation. And the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, it is in their name that I greet us all this wonderful, sunny Florida morning with the beautiful greeting words of peace and paradise. As-salamu
alaykum.
How's everyone this morning? Good. How's everyone this morning? How are we feeling? How are we thinking? How are we living? All praise to God, to Allah. Give yourself a warm round of applause for being in the right place at the right time. We welcome you today to our which is an extension of our local study group, but here also in the Bay Area. The Bay Area study group or the regional study group and mosque are affiliated with the seventh region. Here in the Tampa Bay Area, this is our local teaching and training center for the teachings of the most honorable Elijah Muhammad. Right across the Bay, we have our local mosque, which serves as the chief mosque in this particular district, which is known as the Central District. These centers are set up for the re-education and retraining of our people here in America. You and I must bear witness that we do, in fact, need to be retrained. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Anytime that we can walk up down the street, broad daylight, grown men and now women, with their pants hanging down off of the sides of their behind, off of the sides of their waist, calling each other goons, B's and H's, and you know what those consonants stand for. Dogs, devils, demons, all of the things, beasts, all of the things that we call one another now, we can bear witness that you and I indeed need teaching and training. Is that right?
Yes,
but we need teaching and training and right guidance that will bring us out of the condition that we're in. So to know if we're being trained and taught properly, it is to know that you're being guided out of the condition that you actually exist or live in. So if your condition isn't changing, if life is still foul and flagrant, if life is still negative, producing all of the wrong results, then you and I can conclude.
I saw a picture on Facebook that had a little young girl who was bending over, posing with her behind sticking out. She had a face full of makeup, long extensions on her hair and lipstick. And the caption on the picture said, "Bad little B-I-T-C-H." Not only did it say that, but then the mother was condoning the behavior and praising the behavior and saying, "This is what you need to do now to get a man."
Come on.
So what has happened in society that now we have to demean, demoralize ourselves in order to get the respect of our brothers and to get the respect of our sisters? Isn't that something in the day that we live in? We live in the most modern, technology-oriented, advantage, spiritual information on the superhighways of the internet, but yet we're still living and existing at the lowest plane of human existence. How could this happen in the information age? How could this happen in the time that we have access to multiple millions upon millions of bits of data of our condition? The scriptures in Hosea say that our people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Is that right?
Yes.
But then the scripture carefully describes that those same people who are destroyed go on to reject the knowledge that has been given. So what is it about us now that we reject what is just or what is moral and what is right? What has become so comfortable in us that now we can look at that, those things that are good, those things that are true, those things that are just, those things that are right, those things that are moral, those things that are uplifting, those things that are fashioning us, and we reject that? How is it that we're in this condition today? What is it about you and I and the great commission that we've been given that we've been instructed to make changes in the condition?
Right.
So you are indeed here in the right place because we need to be re-educated. We need to be retrained. Now, the word education is not that traditional definition that we remember in school, right?
Right?
There were the three R's or was it the four R's? There were three. It was reading, writing, and arithmetic, is that right? But the reading has not produced better thinkers, is that right?
That's right.
The writing has not produced better thinking, is that right? And better behavior, is that right? And certainly the arithmetic has not allowed us to solve the mathematical problems that have kept us confined by an enemy who seeks your and my destruction. So indeed we need a teaching and a training, is that right?
Yes, sir.
So here to bring before you, I want to give you myself. So excited to hear from our dear representative today. And we have one of our young student fireballs who's going to take us a little further into the program. So we'd like for you to sit. I think the air is feeling good in here. The climate is good.
That's right.
It's going to heat up a little bit when we start talking about these things that have plagued us so much in our current reality and then the overall impact that they extend internationally. But before we hear from our keynote speaker, I'd like to bring before you our beautiful young sister working hard and being a wonderful reflection of her great parents, Sister Jasmine, who will take us a little further into our program. Please welcome her with a warm round of applause.
Well, the first song that came out today, some words that you probably wasn't familiar with is Alphonse Lakeland and all. Alphonse Lakeland is a greeting that we give to each other that simply means if you feel cute, and the return greeting is always tonight, that means if you feel cute. Another word that you probably wasn't familiar with is Allah. Allah means God in Arabic, like Deal, God of Sin, and Sufi, God of Priest. Also, the sea and the rain. The women sit on this side and the men sit on this side because men and women are naturally attracted to each other. So, since we all came here to this beautiful message today, we don't need to be easily distracted by all the things.
All right.
Last year, we want to briefly go over the checklist. You know, we live in a time where a lot of people, a lot of violence is going on in schools.
Come on, yeah.
So for your safety and protection, everybody's safety and protection makes the girl harm with them.
That's right.
I was going to bring up I leave you as I came before you and greet
the Lord's feet. Oh, like a song. Hey, what's going on?
Our first order is to our people who are in most in need.
Right.
because they are the most destroyed. But we do have a universal expression. And that's why the guest speaker, our brother, the international representative of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, through the Minister Akbar Muhammad, he is here to share with us how we are related to our kith and kin all over the earth.
Right.
For we were taught by God in person the measurements of the earth.
Right.
And the earth measures 196,940 square miles of the planet Earth. So to know your terrain or to know the house which is the home of Islam,
that's right,
that tells you that you and I are not just natural.
Right.
We're just not here as black Americans, but we have family all over the planet.
Right.
Family, they just had me to come to just share a few words. And I am happy to be back here in Tampa with the family that helped produce me. For the Holy Quran says, Brother Theodore, reverence the room that for you. Is there blessing for money down the law? Because if we don't give respect to mother, how can we be respected?
Right.
If you don't give respect to one another, who will respect you if
that's
you don't
right.
respect your other self?
Oh.
That's why we have y'all sitting close to each other. This seating arrangement was set up by the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad because he wanted us to remember that we are family.
Right.
We have been robbed and destroyed as a people. So we thank you, family, for obeying the check procedure, the sign-in procedure, the seating arrangement. I know some of you are sweethearts, brothers. Your girlfriend's over there, brother. Your wife is over there. Sister, your husband is over there. But all of this was set up so that we can reach you because we know by nature the male and the female attract one another. And if we sat you together, you would be magnetically attracted to the electrical power coming from the awesome power of the female. So because we want you to get what you came here for, we separate the sexes so that you can see that we are intelligently using your time so that you can get what you came here for. Is everyone all right?
Yeah.
Can we have a good time?
Yes,
yeah. Sir, family, with no further delay. Let's bring back to the podium our student coordinator, Brother Michael Muhammad. Let's bring him on. Come on with a hearty round of applause. Congratulations. Give him another warm round of applause. Allah's help and victory comes. Is that right?
Yes,
help and victory is soon. Soon and right around the corner. We thank Allah for our mighty, mighty brother. Now, moving on into the program, we have another beautiful sister who we're going to bring before you, a freedom fighter who has done a tremendous job in the community, well studied and well traveled. Our sister's work in the Black Star Action Network, and now moving on to bigger and better and greater things. She brings a wealth of knowledge and information, and we're very excited to have her on our program today. Please help me and join me with a warm, rousing round of applause for Sister Ayapo Nzinga.
As-salamu
alaykum.
All right. I want to express profound gratitude and appreciation for this brother inviting me to speak today. It was actually surprising. I usually am so into work that I don't think about getting out and speaking as often as I should, but I appreciate it and am really grateful. Before I speak, I usually ask that the ancestors speak through me and that everything that I say is a representation of their will through me on earth, and I think that's really important. I think that all too often, African people in this country, because we have been deprived of a relationship with our ancestors and our history, that we don't move according to their will for us in the world. And the fact of the matter is, you know, we have estimates ranging anywhere from 250 million to 500 million Africans, Black Lives Lost, as a consequence of this relationship that we have to the Western world and our people seek redemption, our people seek retribution. And until we fulfill our obligation on earth, our circumstances as a people are never going to change. Every last one of us born with black skin have a responsibility to our people, period. And I teach my children that way and everybody I come in contact with. And everything that we do has to be representative of our mission to free our people.
Right.
Where I'm coming from, first of all, let me just give a little background about who I am and how I got started very, very briefly. My name is Yapo Nguyen-De Ngina, and I have been a political organizer now for about 13 years in the Tampa Bay area. I moved to St. Petersburg from Birmingham, Alabama, as backwards as black people can be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a drug addict. I was engaged to a white boy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every host of backwards behavior that African people can participate in, I probably participated. And when I came to St. Petersburg, I met the Uhuru Movement in St. Pete. And that began, you know, my transformation into understanding who I was and what my role was on earth, what my responsibility was.
Right.
And as a consequence of doing work with the Uhuru Movement, I began to kind of ask myself, like, what can I do? What is it that I have that I can use to help my people? I started working in the health field through the movement. I started managing their health food store and coordinating their wellness outreach program. And I was already pretty well-versed in herbs, so it seemed like a natural progression. And then I got to a point where I decided that I'd reached my limitations in terms of what it was I was able to offer our people. And so I went back to school. I've been in school now for about 9.5 years pursuing an education in traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a long haul, let me just tell you. But in 6 months, I will be a doctor of Oriental medicine.
All right.
Say that no matter what the venue is, it's because our people are so demoralized.
Right.
Our people have been so beaten and battered by the media and propaganda and every hope of medium that these people have used to suppress and subjugate our people.
Right.
And for me, as a black woman born in America, born self-loathing,
mm-hmm.
is the epitome of self-hatred.
Right. Right.
You understand? Sitting in closet, smoking crack, you know what I mean, engaged in the most backward kind of relationship for something as simple as knowing who you are to transform your brain is huge. And when I had only been clean 2 years. When I got clean, it wasn't a self-cut program, it wasn't, you know, going to church, you know, or none of that. It was saying, black people need more from me than I'm able to give right now. And I was only clean 2 years when I decided I was going to go to school. And everybody said I was crazy. What are you thinking, woman? You are 30 years old. You're going to school for medicine. You'll be in school for a decade. I was like, this is what I'm called to do.
Right.
Oh. So, and the opposition was massive. And the struggle continues to be mountainous. But in 5.5, almost 6 months, I'll be done and be able to do for my people what my people need for me. When I speak to young people, I go to a lot of like charter schools, African Center charter schools, speak mostly to kids who are getting ready to graduate and what have you. And that's the thing that I tell them, is that everything you ever thought you knew about the world, take it, follow it up, put it in a trash receptacle, and start all over.
Right.
Because I was an awful student in high school. You know, in know how they tell our kids.
You don't make straight A's, you can't go to college.
Right. If you don't make straight A's, you ain't going to have no opportunity. You can't get no good job. Blah, 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 blah. I was an awful student. I had a, my 12th grade teacher told me on the day before we were supposed to march, she, you know, to graduate, she said, you know that you should not be walking tomorrow. I said, yes, ma'am, I know. She said, if it weren't for a sympathetic heart and me knowing your potential, you would not be graduating tomorrow. So that just to say that we have within us the ability to serve and serve in a way that can uplift not only us, fulfill our aspirations, fulfill our potential, but become an example of what you can overcome with just knowledge of self. That's it. That's it. Just knowing who you are and where you came from. That's it. So anyway, I always have to start that way because I feel like, you know, our people, man, are so demoralized. I mean, I live in one of the most impoverished communities in Tampa, and, you know, it was really hard to see our people, you know, messed up on drugs. And you know how this society does. It criminalizes our people, you know, call them crackheads and all these demoralizing characterizations as if their value is somehow less because their circumstances have put them in this state.
Right, right, right.
And, you know, and I know what it is to be there. So I feel like, you know, we the work that we have to do is massive. There's no, the work that we have to accomplish is huge. And we have to be responsible for one another. We have to take who we see as the most backwards of our people and transform their brains.
Right.
We have a responsibility to do that. So anyway, the topic of today was around the question of Black people in America and what our responsibility is in terms of this attack that's being made on the Muslim world through the United States, right, in the Western world. Now, I am sure that the guest, the keynote speaker, is going to be much more versed on this topic specifically, but what I really wanted to talk about was more in line with my political work and what our responsibilities are here as Africans. You know, the fact of the matter is the history of the United States, what is happening in broad daylight before our eyes is nothing new.
Right?
It's a strategy that has been conducted for about the last 70 years, last 60 years. And it's the whole world scope, the whole world stage centers around conquest of resources. We cannot overcomplicate what America and Europe aims are. What we're seeing happening on the continent under a Negro president is outright colonialism. We call it neo-colonialism because it's painted black. But the fact of the matter is it is about to be direct white rule on our continent. And this Negro is going to usher in the new era of direct white rule if we don't intervene. The importance of this is I have a whole lot of statistics about the nature of the economic conquest, the history of Africa, of the IMF and the World Bank and the Third World. The use of the IMF and the World Bank is almost like a mafia-style loan-sharking organization that deliberately placed the Third World in poverty and used that as the auspices of the extraction, the further extraction of resources from Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The response from Africans in America has been muted. I don't know if people are experiencing the world, the political world, the way that I am experiencing. But historically, especially since Africans have been here in America, the African people have been the most progressive force in the country, period. Every major movement was ushered in by the motion of African people just fighting for a right to live. You know, white women got their right to vote coasting off the motion of African people trying to get free. White women came, you know, out of the closet or were able to burn their bras or come out of the kitchen coasting off of the destruction of the Black Power movement and the Civil Rights movement in 1960.
Right.
everybody has been able to benefit socially from the motion of African people. And even the whole question of civil rights, legislation and how, you know, at least we're, you hear black uninformed, ill-informed African people say this all the time. Well, you know, things are so much better now than they were way back then.
Right.
You know, at least we can go to school with white people now. Right. At least we can sit next to white people in the toilet, you know, in the bathroom. And what it has done is given us an easier opportunity to participate in our own exploitation. What it has done is completely glaze over our eyes the very real circumstances that African people are confronted with. We are in worse shape now than we ever have been. If you pay attention, white people talk about it all the time. They tell you in broad daylight. You know, Negro, you worse off and you don't even know no better because you got an iPhone. Because you can drive an Escalade. Right? I read an article in the New York Times in 2008. That was, I wish I would have saved this article. I have to find the archive of this article. The New York Times, they were talking, this was right before Obama got elected, and they were talking about the economic crisis coming off of the subprime mortgage scandal, the housing crisis, or the housing bubble bursting, right? And one of the things, several things that this article said. And I couldn't even believe there was so bodacious to print it in black and white. You know, we didn't pay attention, so they don't have to worry about that.
Right.
So the article said that before that subprime mortgage scandal of 2006, it was estimated that it was going to take black people, because you know it's our responsibility to close the wealth gap. It was going to take black folks 400 to 500 years to close the gap in wealth between black and white America, right? After the subprime mortgage scandal, it was estimated that it would take 10 times that amount of time to close the gap in wealth, 4,000 to 5,000 years to close the gap, the wealth gap between black and whites in America. They understood and printed that the subprime mortgage scandal was the greatest theft of black wealth in the history of this country, right? And somehow we still are unable, all these years later, to see that what is happening to our people and what's calculated. The subprime mortgage scandal wasn't a big blunder or an accident. It was Wall Street bankers and politicians getting together under Bush saying, how are we going to get these black people and these Mexicans money? We need everybody in this country to buy a house. So what we're going to do is we're going to allow them to buy this house real cheap. We're going to bring them in, say, you got bad credit, don't worry about it. We're going to give you the house where you can afford it. We're just going to give you this adjustable rate, right? And you can only, you know, pay $500 a month on your house and you can have your house. And after years and years and years of making your payments on time, all of a sudden, your rate goes up from $500
right.
to $1,200,
right?
And you fight and fight and fight to pay this $1,200 a month mortgage because you've invested all this work and all this money into buying this home. And what happened in the end was when you couldn't keep up with your payment, not only did they take all your money and all your work, all the years that you put into that house, but now they take your house,
right?
It was grand theft to the greatest degree. And the woman that devised the loan, the predatory lending or the predatory loan, Penny Pritzker, is your president's chief economist, chief economic advisor. These things are not accidental, right? And so the other thing that the article said that was really revealing, to, and I always use this when some ill-informed black person tells me how much better off we are, right, is in 1900, according to the New York Times, in 1900, black people in America owned more land in 1900 than we do today. In 1920, black people owned more businesses, five times more businesses in 1920 than we do today.
Right.
So when someone tells you that we've done so much better, we have to be able to say in very specific terms, this is how we're worse off.
Absolutely.
The rate of incarceration of African women has risen 400% since 1975.
Mm-hmm.
an outright attack on African women, who have always been seen as the stronghold of the African community, as these assaults were made on African men. That no matter how bad African men had it, women were going to keep it together. Women were going to hold the community together. I'm in the health field, so I used to do a radio show, and I did this presentation on the infant mortality rate, right? And these are the things that we have to think about. Something is happening here to our people. In 23 years ago? In 1990, two babies born, a white baby and a black baby, prematurely, of the same birth weight and the same gestational period. The black baby was two times more likely to survive than the white baby. Fast forward 15 years, as of 2005, those statistics have completely reversed. That a black child is two times more likely to die than the white baby of the same low birth weight and the same pre-gestational period. So what is that? Is it all of a sudden black women are doing something differently? Is it just their diet? Is the social pressure and stress of being black in America? Because the fact of the matter is that there was a recent article that just came out that said women not born in America, immigrants, African immigrant women who move to America and have their first child have birth statistics that mirror white women, meaning successful, birthing, full-term babies, you know, chubby babies, that kind of thing, right? By the time that first child is old enough to have a baby, that child, right, their birthing statistics look exactly like black women in America. So what is it? Is it the fact that that the women came from somewhere else? It is the conditions imposed on black people in America. And the fact of the matter is the media is working overtime to convince our people that nothing is wrong. It is creating psychoses in our own brains. Because what we see on TV, that everything is fine, everything is great. You know, you're a black man. All you got to do is be strong and an athlete. You still got a white wife and a nice house and a fat car and a fat paycheck, right? Everything's cool on the one hand. And on the other hand, the world you live in is telling you that things are all completely bad. Right. Something is wrong. Something is happening with our children. Yeah. How is it, if everything is okay, that a Trayvon Martin can happen in 2012.
Right.
How is it? If everything has changed and we have arrived because we got a Negro in office, St. Petersburg can have in the last 10 years 7 young African men killed by the police with no repercussions.
No repercussions.
7 in the last 10 years, all of them under the age of 20.
That's right.
Killed by the police. And you don't hear nothing about them on the news because they were cold thugs.
Right.
Because their life had no value.
Right.
So, you know, African people have a responsibility, and unfortunately for us, we have the greatest responsibility.
Right.
African people in America have the greatest responsibility to change the world, I'm telling you.
Right.
Everybody on earth is looking to us. So it demoralizes the rest of the world when they see the conditions of our people. We're groveling on the ground behind white people, begging people for jobs. The rest of the world historically has looked at Africans in America as the most directly oppressed by white power to change the world.
Right.
That's why people upheld the Black Panther Party. So we really have to struggle with our young people. We really have a lot of work to do very, very rapidly. I want to express appreciation again for the opportunity to speak. I know it kind of went off topic for a
minute. Please give another warm round of applause. My mighty sister Queen, wonderful job. As we accelerate into our program family, we have another guest speaker who will speak to us before we bring on our keynote speaker. So please welcome us, please
allow us to welcome with a warm round of applause at 82 years young, and as the Christian song says, I ain't no ways tired.
Right.
Our dear brother has worked so hard in the Tampa area with his prison extension program through the Coach Foundation and all of the great work that he's done with the city leaders here. So we're so thankful to have him today to share a few words with us. So please join us in welcoming Brother Willie Dixon.
It's a pleasure to be here. At 82, it's a pleasure to be anywhere. I have a lot to say, but a short time to say it, so I have to do that brother's job and say, I got to hit it.
Hit it!
In the prison ministry, they give you 5 minutes. You got to do what you got to do.
Come on, man.
So they put me out.
Yeah.
And all the brothers put me out here. But I would just like to just piggyback. I hate to use the word
piggyback.
I follow up on what Sister Queen was talking about. It's amazing that here is the map of Africa. But first, I just like to clear up a lot of myths and I have some questions. Now, tomorrow is what day? Columbus Day. They celebrated Columbus Day. She was an alligator going in the wrong direction.
She yeah.
found a nation that was already there.
Yeah.
And they acknowledged him as being some great man.
Yeah.
Okay, what is Susie?
She's
Yeah. Now, you know more about Columbus than you do about me. Okay. All right. Since I don't have much time, I would like to just pick it back on what Sister Queen said, and I sent out an email yesterday. I sent out a lot of emails. They get tired of me, but they said, you know the truth, and the truth makes it free. If you set somebody free, you can count them again.
Right.
But if you make them free, they're free indeed.
Come on.
Now, what I sent out yesterday's email, I was talking about our tax dollars. And I'm going to Brother Muhammad and Brother Ali. They're having a meeting at the Children's Board. No tax dollars. But what I said, the people are meeting to talk about how they're going to spend the money that you have put into this multi-million dollars. And I said, the people need to show up or even shut up. We as a people are reactionary. We always wait for something to happen, and then we want to go and want to change everything. Now, and my future sister talked about integration. But see, I was there before there was integration. I was there before the cell phone. I was there before TV. And really, we didn't have a little crystal radio. But we had neighborhoods. And then I was wondering what happened in 1963. In 2013, has anything changed?
No.
We've had the March on Washington. We had the Million Man March. And what has changed in our community? Tell me what's changed. It's worse. And as I was coming, they were talking about the war on drugs. Well, it's not really the war on drugs, it's the war on blacks.
Right.
Because there is a proverb that says that give strong drink to those who are perishing. His mother, Lehman's mother, told him to say, now, it's not for kings to drink strong drink. It's for those who are perishing, those who are dying, but the strong drink today is drugs. So they bring it into the black community.
Yes.
We don't have any ships or airplanes to bring
it. Come on, right.
But yet you bring it to our community. You know, because once, you see, I was addicted to drugs for 25 years. So I told a young lady yesterday, I said, the only thing I ever loved was syrup. That's the only thing that makes me wake up 2 o'clock in the morning and go get drugs.
All right.
I couldn't go to sleep unless I had drugs. But I could go to sleep without one. So, but we didn't know any better. When you don't know any better, you can't do any better. But I'm here to tell you that it's been since June September 1975, that I had my last young girl.
Go ahead.
You got teeth. And sometimes I tell them, I say, you know, when I go to the prison, sometimes I tell you the word, and I either look at the Quran or the Bible or the Torah.
That's right.
You will get so high, feel like you want to hold it.
Yeah.
Knowledge gives you, see, all the things knowledge, what it does, it gives you adrenaline to change what's on the inside of you.
Yeah.
But how many of you, but now, we as a people need to get together. And you know, yesterday I was reading this. And we have it in front of us. He's going to let me know in the last 2 minutes. Don't look like I've been up for 2 minutes. Now here, how many familiar with this?
Oh, man.
How many of you familiar with this? So what are you doing about it? Now, I always like to have some proof to show you what we're doing.
Okay, man.
And I'm looking for it, but take my word for it. I got here. Do you know that black people spend over $1 trillion?
Yes.
For years, but how much of that money is going to the black neighborhood? Why don't we get together and start producing? But you mean all of the money, they talk about the drop money. But see, when they get the drop money, they go buy
our
they spend it in the neighborhood. If I would have got some of that drop money, I would change my name with the Mississippi stock all over again. But you know what they do? They live in the housing project. Some of them got a boat in the project. They're not around with the big wheel
waiting for the rain.
They all know they don't have a job. People might be crazy, but they ain't stupid. But nevertheless,
come on.
My passion is the prison ministry. The word prison is ignorance. See, because prison keeps you confined. And a lack of knowledge keeps you confined to what you can know, do, and understand.
Yeah.
But you must know how in order to take knowledge
All right. And
understand it and wisdom to know what to do with it. I don't care what university you go to, without the knowledge of God, you don't know what to do with what you know. So, Brother Michael is there. Just like in the prison, when you see the guard come, you know you gotta go. So I wanna say this. The first time when I came in this hotel, I saw this. And this paper cost $2. It's free downstairs. How many of you think of the Wall Street Journal? See, you're supposed to get inside, get knowledge. Look, I don't carry the Bible with me. I don't carry the Quran with me because that's on the inside of me.
Come on.
I carry what they're thinking about me. We are in a land called Babylon. God is not going to take you out of here, but he wants you to be an example for others to see, to know how to live.
That's right.
So, brothers and sisters, I wish I had more time. But I'm time wasting on me. But I want to show you this. Another myth. I got 2 minutes now.
2 minutes.
30 seconds. I want you to know there are a lot more black men in prison than in college. It's a lie.
Right. That's right.
Because college age is from 18 to 22. Mm-hmm. And also, if you do the statistics, which I do, I know that you have more black men in college than in prison. So they want you to think that.
Right.
Next thing is, they say that you've been to prison, you can't get a job. Now, this is my FBI record. As long as you're on. I got a full pardon. Last year, the city of Tampa gave me over $2 million to build houses. And I meant to bring my book up here, and I got pictures with the mayor, even with President Obama's wife. Mr. Farrakhan. So, don't let anyone tell you your past will determine your future. You will determine your future.
Wonderful job, and all due respect,
dear Rev. All due respect, dear Rev. I didn't want to run you off. It was good. We having fun today, man.
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you. Now to bring on our keynote address. We have our mighty brother that worked so hard in helping us to lay the foundation here in the city of Tampa. So without further ado, moving forward into our program, I bring before us Student Minister James Muhammad.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the one God to whom all praise is due, the Lord of the world.
All right.
We thank Almighty God, Allah, for blessing us by making himself known, the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, through whom we now know that Allah God has appeared in the person of Master Farad Muhammad, the long-awaited Mahdi of the Muslims and the Messiah of the Christians. We thank him for the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, whom we now know to be the Exalted Christ, the one whom the world has been awaiting and expecting for the past 2,000 years. Little did we know that it would not be the popularized image that we have been given ever since we've been here in America of a Caucasian. And even less did we anticipate that he would be a Muslim. But we stand before you today by the grace of God to declare that the Christ that you have been awaiting and the world has been awaiting is here.
All right.
And he's a black man from among the former.
All right, go ahead.
We can never thank Allah and the Christ enough for that one whom Allah, through the Christ, has fashioned and shaped and prepared for this critical hour at which we have arrived. The hour of which I speak is the hour of the judgment of both the righteous and the wicked and the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth. And the man of whom I speak is the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. It is in their name that I'm very happy and honored to greet all of you with the greeting words of peace. We say it once again in the Arabic language, As-salamu alaykum. Oh, I want to thank you, Brother Michael, for allowing me this introduction. I thank him for his humility, and I thank him because I have such a special relationship with the brother whom we are about to introduce in a very few minutes, Brother Minister. This is the minister, by the grace of Allah, through whom 41 years ago, going on 42 years ago, I was blessed to receive my act. But little did I know that in 1989, my wife, who I just celebrated my 31st anniversary with, also would accept through Student Minister Abdul Akbar Muhammad. So I am doubly blessed by Allah through this man. Now all of you, or most of you, should know that he is the student international representative of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. He has traveled throughout the world. I think it's 144 countries. Brother Minister, is that correct? He's been all through Africa. He's been all over the world representing the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and the teaching of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I was blessed to meet him at that fateful time. I met a strong disciplinarian. At that time, his name was Larry 4X, and he did not play. Didn't play. I won't go into some of the things that we were blessed to learn and to be disciplined under his leadership. However, it is my esteemed honor. There's so much more that I could say. but I want to bring him before you and waste no more time. I am honored and privileged to bring before you, to present to most of you and introduce to some of you, the international representative of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam, our brother, our minister, the, I'm going to say honorable, because he is honorable, Student Minister Abdul Akbar Muhammad. Let's bring him on with a round of applause.
Brothers and sisters, first and foremost, I want to thank God for being a family. I've known him for quite a while, and I've asked this for his assistance. As far as I'm looking forward to it, the tremendous thing of this month celebrates the 18th anniversary of the Charter.
Yes, sir.
I have one more city to my heart until after I come to Guyana. I hope for the second Sunday to visit Guyana. Then I think I'll be able to get the whole state. But I'm very honest. First, to thank you for giving me an opportunity to get all the help and support that I believe and I hope to get a lot of the show. Carries a tremendous weight and carries it so beautifully. And as Brother Fontaine said, he was Sunday, he was their beautiful man. I'm a witness that first met in 1965 by 65 years ago, and that's enough. We have a long history together. Through many ups and downs, and then we build a nation system. Many of us came in after we started building. And the most important thing that I've learned is number one, dedication to our young people. We could not go anywhere without them. Carry them along. Some of them come along thinking it's straight. The world is so attractive out there. They want to be a part of that world instead of the world of the country. It's my sister, Vic, that's built in. It's big. Yes. Okay. I really enjoy it for the long. And there is something that is on the television now, and I want to try to see if I can read it. It says that Delta Airlines does it. It says that you can't cling to the past if you want to create a new future. And that's a misstatement. That's a misstatement because it's the past that you learn. If that's the case, why do they teach Americans? All the think tanks in America do studies on what happened before, try to give them some guidance. And this is just a cliche that they use by Delta Airlines to promote it. But our young people, I was thinking about her talking about the destruction of the black of the great people and the attempt to even destroy the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam is like ground. There's a book called Waiting for the Midnight Sun by a brother named Fernell Joseph. And he probably is of Haitian descent because Joseph is a popular name, last name, Haiti. Anybody here have relatives in Haiti? One, okay. And he wrote in the book, beautiful book, the professor, he just left Columbia. I don't know what school he's at now. But he wrote in the book about the Nation of Islam. Was the root of our struggle. We're 83 years old in America. For 83 years, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad struggled to enlighten our people, to open up a mind that was fooled by white America and to enlighten them, and not to enlighten them, but engage in the struggle of this world that destroys our people. So Minister Farrakhan has been that spark that has lit our people up, even those who don't to a barn that we're trying to just proselytize.
Right.
That's not the case. Any brother or sister who thinks like that, then you really don't understand. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad did speak clearly to the black man when he said that my duty is only to deliver a clear message.
Wow.
What you do with the message is up to you. Some cling to the message because they see salvation in it. Some
mm-hmm.
use it so that they can walk in the darkness that America has created for black America. And so in that darkness where we're groping for ideas and trying to get our act together, then you need some light.
Right.
And that's what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad offers to black America now through his servant and disciple, Minister Louis Farrakhan. Now, I'm not a brother who just heard Minister Farrakhan, but I've been with him for years. I watched him when things were really bad. We had to put him on a plane, and we had to drive to meet him in the city. We'd leave a group, would leave a day before because we had no money. And he was determined when we were in Uganda in 1977, and then from Uganda we went to Libya and then to Mecca. We made Umrah. He was determined, after watching the effects of what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad gave him on black people in Uganda, he was determined to come back to America and rebuild the Nation of Islam with the ideas of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad at the base of it. And he did just that. He had a focused determination to do that. And the reason I'm saying this, because if we do anything, it's our young people who are most important, those young brothers and sisters that I see sitting in this audience. You can't neglect them. You can't overlook them. You can't be afraid of them. You have to engage them. You have to get them involved. And when you begin to give them, enlighten them, you can see their eyes open up. And, you know, some people say, I don't like to be the smartest person in the room. But the people that they hang out with, once you enlighten them, they end up being the smartest one in the room. And when they open their mouth and engage others, others respect the wisdom that they got. And so there's going to be continuity and continuation
right.
of the Nation of Islam. Our young people have to be brought into the mix. And the way, how do you bring them in the mix? You let them travel with you. You become a mentor and you talk to them. This is not my subject. I'm just opening this up because I see all these beautiful young men and these young sisters here. And so you don't want them to fight coming to the mosque. It's like I used to go to Sunday school when I was a little boy in New York City. And the reason I would get dressed and go because they gave us donuts and hot chocolate. But anything else, I wasn't going because I was so interested in getting into my Bible study. But it was the donuts and the hot chocolate that made me want to go to the Sunday school on Sunday. So it has to be something that brings them to the mosque. Otherwise, it brings them to a church. But it's something that they can use as a tool to deal with the outside world. So let me first, Ayapo Nzinga, is that how you say it?
Empty, and you don't understand what you're dealing with, and you don't know how to deal with the Caucasian white man, if you please. If you don't know how to deal with him because your head is empty, then you're always going to be a Negro. She described it right. You know, now personally, I always loved Barack. I had so much hope in him. But as the minister says, that he was selected before he was elected, and he's in between a rock and a hard place, and you could see that during the Syrian crisis, he must have went home and made a prayer that he didn't have to go into Syria because they were pushing him to do it. He didn't want to do it, and when he flipped it over to the Congress and he saw that the votes were against it completely, because even the American people who are apolitical and don't understand, they know that we have destroyed nations over there. We've spent billions of dollars, and there is no democracy or freedom. Iraq is in chaos. They're about to leave Afghanistan. It is in chaos. They look at Libya, it is in chaos. There's Egypt, it is in chaos. There's chaos in Tunisia. All of these places are messed up in the guise that we were bringing democracy to the Muslim world. And now that so-called democracy has created chaos. American businesses can't operate in Egypt.
the 9 million tourists that would go to Egypt every year, that was the base of their economy, nobody is going there now. So the Middle East is not better off. The Middle East is destroyed. So I just want to say that my subject today is the Islamic world at war with itself and the impact on Muslims in America. And I want to say, Sister Paulette, you just came from Fiji Islands. And when I traveled around the world in 1986, when I left America, it was my first stop. I flew to San Francisco. I stopped in the, what is the island? Tahiti, and then I went to the Fijis. And let me tell you the story that I tell about traveling. Malcolm X used to say in the mosque, he was my first minister, and what he used to say was, traveling broadens one scope. And sometimes, even you in Tampa, you should go to other cities and look. Sometimes you get so close to home, you don't want to travel. One thing every member of the Nation of Islam in this room can attest, when you join the nation, you start traveling. And you had a reason to travel. When we brought 1,900 people to Ghana in 1994 in October, it'll be 20 years next year, those 1,900 brothers and sisters and visitors that came, they had a reason to go. It's like going to Hajj from Mecca. Going to Mecca, you have a reason to go to Hajj, but traveling broadens your scope. So when I first went to Fiji, where she just came back, I landed in, I didn't land in Nandi, which is the capital. I landed in Suva. Suva, is that how you pronounce that? And I went to a hotel, and that's the tourist side of the island. And I'm going to show you how this white man is. And some sisters, they have big afros. Most people think that in the Fiji Islands that they're Polynesian, but they're African. They're black people. Because when the plane landed, I looked out the window and I saw this brother walking with this big afro. And I said to the guy sitting next to me, I said, where do those people come from? He looked out the window and said, they're Fijians. And I'm sitting there. I think I know a little about the world. I'm sitting there. I said, Fijian. So I get off the plane. I'm in the hotel, walking down the lobby. And two sisters pass me. And they said, Bula Bula. I said, Bula Bula. Now, you got to be in the Over the Hill gang to understand this. We used to look at Tarzan movies, my brother. And what did they say in the Tarzan movie? Bula Bula. Here, see how that white man, I mean, he's something. This is the language of the people in the Fiji, and he made it look like some Africans in the jungle with spears saying Bula Bula. I mean, he's something else. But he could do that because your minds were not open. You didn't know any better. You didn't know. And he was the one that fed you everything you had. So I want to try to walk through this because, you know, when I lecture, I always like to open the floor for questions. And I do that because my teacher, when I first came into Islam, I was 18 years old for the young brothers here. I was one of those lost souls in New York, trying to get my balance, running around, smoking a little dope, and trying to run the girls down and my little jazz albums under my arm, you know, thinking I was going to be into something. And a brother took me to the mosque, and that was it. It was history. But the reason that I'm saying this is that we have to know what's happening with our young people. Now, there's a lot going on in the world about Islam. And if the outside world shapes how you view Islam, just like they shaped how I looked at the words Bula Bula by their movie, they're shaping how you view Muslims. And right now, you don't have a good view of Muslims. Right. All of the suicide bombing and the trade fair, the bombing on 9/11 and all of that in 2001, all of that's in your brain. And you're trying to figure out where these Muslims are at, but you know that the black people who have accepted Islam in America are different because the power of the word of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the knowledge of ourselves gave us the strength to pull away from the negative things that destroyed us as a people, and also learn how to work with each other. With all of the baggage that we have, we're able to organize and work with each other. Because thing about baggage, when you come and accept what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is teaching, you don't leave the baggage outside. You bring it with you. And so as you try to work through being a Muslim and living according to what is prescribed in the Holy Quran and the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, your baggage is right there. What it does give you the power to do is to manage that baggage. You understand? You can manage it. It doesn't become so overwhelming that you go get a drink or go shoot some dope or get a crack pipe or go get you some mollies. Okay? It gives you the ability to deal with it because the pressure on the outside, you got enough in your brain to understand the pressure and deal with it. When people have pressure, the pressure is what causes the collapse. You call it a nervous breakdown. It drives Negroes crazy because of the pressure of the white man's world. So you got to be able to deal with that pressure in order to move forward. So I want to just go into this for a minute because I think that it's important for us to understand what we are challenged with. Minister Farrakhan comes on every week, and he's committed to do 52 weeks of the time and what must be done. And his message is try to give us some enlightenment of how we can move and handle our lives and the challenges that we have in the world. And when we do this, it's not that we're just against America. We're against the errant foreign policy of America and its domestic policy vis-a-vis black people. The whole issue of the government closing down and Obamacare, as they're calling it, instead of calling it universal health care for the people of America, the whole issue is a black man in the White House, and they want his legacy to be the worst president in the history of America. And it's the right-wing white folks who have this kind of idea. And as my sister was talking, I thought about a group of people organized. In the state of Florida, I was in Fort Pierce about a killing of a black man. And if you look across the state, but you need a group, and it don't have to be a group that is fueled, and the idea comes from people outside of our community, but we got enough intelligent black people say that we're going to set up a committee and monitor every city in the state of Florida when a black man or a black woman is killed, when they are harassed by the police, and you put it on a scale. And if you do that, you find out that you can get something done in terms of holding down the brute force of the police and other white folks. I mean, it is a tragedy to see this George Zimmerman, who killed a 17-year-old boy and then goes before a jury of six women. One of them was, only one of them was a minority. I don't know. I haven't seen a picture. Was she a Latino? But the rest of them found this man innocent and let him walk. And then as God would have it, you saw the real person when he got into that thing with his wife. And it showed you something about his mentality when he shot down. But how could they free him and let him walk away like that? And then we don't have the power or the strength to lobby the government because now it fades. It just goes away. Everybody gets busy with their problems. But you need people who are committed to a cause. How I see the Nation of Islam, you know, and it's not blowing the horn of the nation, but in a way it is. But that, and I'm saying that the nation, you're the most disciplined, well-organized group in America. You're in 163 cities. You got cadres in all that city. You have the only national black newspaper. There's a lot that you can do. But if you get bogged down in petty stuff, if you make the mosque a patent place where you're talking about who's marrying who and what somebody, then you lose focus of what your real duty is. Your duty is to resurrect our people, to organize our people, not to get bogged down in favors. I was telling the minister, I was sitting with him at the farm just a few weeks ago, and I was telling him about bourgeois Muslims. Those are Muslims who get dressed up, put your bow tie on, your nice suit, get into your nice car and drive by the hood and don't even look around. You understand? And you don't stop the car and say, let me go and I see if I can get some brothers. Because the brother may not become a Muslim tomorrow, but you plant something in his head that he'll never forget. It'll stick with him. And so you say, I want you to go out and spend an hour and a half with me. And what you get in an hour and a half will help you as a guiding principle the rest of your life. Do you know the young brothers in New York? That when we talked about hog eaters and eating hogs, how we were able to get them to be, they called it poison animal eaters. That brother's a swine eater. And he wasn't a Muslim, but he stopped eating swine. And there was a culture in New York where the young brothers, if they thought they were hip and into something, they were not swine eaters. And they just came to a meeting. And a good minister talked about swine, poison, the poison meat that poisoned your brain. You wonder why you can't think? And then anything you do, you always get busted in it, how you can't maneuver in school because you're a poison animal eater. And that swine that you eat make you think slow. That's why when you go to jail, they feed you all that swine. So you can't think your way out of jail, So you got to stop eating swine in order to get yourself together. Then talk about the swine real bad. And it helped the young brother. So we have to look at it. We have a message. And I'm saying this with our guests in here, because our guests know exactly what's happening with us. You got to be committed to the redemption of your people. Brother Michael, with Brother James and Brother Kareem, who is a veteran and a senior, who can always kind of give guidance and give the example of history of how we built New York City, which was the largest and the most powerful mosque in the Nation of Islam under the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He said he can give you guidance so that we can make Islam live. This is your hour. And why in your hour you going to sit over in the corner and say things are not going too bad, going too well, the mosque is not full, and you know, we having a difficult time. This is your hour. And if God gives you this time and you are alive, then you got to make something out of it. Because soon all of us will leave here. My brother, you said it right, Reverend. You said that at 82 years old, I'm glad to be seen anywhere. Just to be here is a blessing at 82 years old. So I'm saying that this is our hour. Now let me try to get to my subject. I want to lay that out. Because we got all of these young brothers here. And I have to go back into an aspect of it that I said last night when we were in Fort Pierce. And that's the drug culture in America and how it's destroying the fabric of our youth. Okay, I got to talk about it again because we got these young brothers and sisters in here, and they're all pulled by that. Those are forces that pull on you. How you resist them, you got to have a goal and a vision in front of you. But if you, as I said last night, but if you're like a ship at sea with no captain at the helm, you're tossed about by the winds. You end up as a shipwrecked soul on some shore. You don't know where you're going. So you got to have something in front of you. You got to have a focus in front of you of what you want to do in life. You know, they say that aim for the stars, but accept the moon. You may not get to the star, but the moon is somewhere that maybe you didn't anticipate. It's like in the old days in the migration. People leaving Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, North Carolina in particular, heading to New York. And they got, I'm going to New York, but they got stuck in Baltimore. They got stuck in Philadelphia. They didn't get to New York, but at least they moved about. So you got to have focus on where you want to go in life, and that way you got to aim for it. And you got something to do in life, not just go and hang out on the corner, smoke some dope, look at the girls go by, no focus at all. And then you end up going to jail, doing 5 years first, the second time, 10 years. And jail is another form of slavery in America. So we want to help our young people. That is our objective. Now, we're Muslims, and the world of Islam is under tremendous attack. The attack on Muslims is like unseen. There's in the history of the world in dealing with religion. Now, there's a book that was produced called Legislating Fear, Islamophobia and Its Impact in the United States. Now, these are the people like this. It was named Terry Jones, the guy in Florida who wanted to burn Qurans, okay? He's in this book, and they printed a map. CARE did this, and it's something that you have to order. This is a map of all of the anti-Muslim groups in America. Now, some people say this, and they got them all on here. I think he's on here somewhere. I know I saw him this morning. I was showing it to Brother Brian. But he's on here. And this is the money that they raised in order to fight Islam. And I'll never forget when Bush started in Iraq, he took one of the most brilliant black women that we have, even though she's a Negro, my sister. She is Condoleezza Rice, but she's brilliant. She studied Russian history. She knows Russia. She had got a PhD. She went to Stanford as a professor. Bush took her and said, I want you to go and talk to the people in Hollywood and tell them that I need them to help me in this war with Iraq. And Iraq didn't do anything, really. And Saddam Hussein didn't have any weapons. They used another brother, brilliant brother, parents from Jamaica, named Colin Powell. He stood before the UN and spent a fantastic tale about how Saddam Hussein had nuclear capabilities and it was a threat to America to justify going in there and knocking him off so they could seize the oil fields. So what you have now in America is this whole anti-Islamic group that's raising money. And some of us say that's them Arabs, man, and them Indo-Pakistanis and them other people. That's not us. Don't ever think like that. That's how some of the Jews thought during the time of Hitler. We are doctors. We play music for the Germans, and they put them in the ovens with everybody else because it was against what they were. And it's the same thing if you're involved in Islam. Now, the thing about it is that these groups, and they got you should see the names. I hope you can order one from the CARE, Council on American Islamic Relationships. It's called CARE. You can write it down. They got an 800 number. They'll get the email, and you can order this book. And when you go through it, you'll see how there's a group called the Fear of Sharia coming to America. There's a group that don't want any mosques in Tennessee. The big challenge in Tennessee, the people voted that these Muslims cannot build a mosque in our community. And we're supposed to live in a country where there's freedom of religion, okay? That these women cannot come with their heads covered, okay? They don't want it. Our children cannot be excused from school to go to Juma prayer on Friday. All of these things are anti-Islam, against our faith. And though you're getting into Islam, you're new to the equation, but you have to understand that America fears the power of Islam in America. And they fear even young white Americans will convert to Islam. But they know the power of Islam in the black community. And the root of that is that many of us who came to this country as slaves, when we came here as slaves, remember, Christianity hadn't started spreading in Africa. So they were either Muslims or animists. And there is a book produced by Yale University. Took 12 years to produce it. They only printed limited copies. Now, I thought at one time it was 300 copies, but I don't know. You can get it online, and whenever I come to speak, there's always a book involved. So get a pen and piece of paper so you can write it down. But when the slave trade started in West Africa, there's a country of Senegal right here, and even Mauritania, the southern part of Mauritania right here, they brought slaves from this whole coast. And in this book, The Atlas of the Transatlantic Slave Trade, they talked about the prize slaves. The most choice slaves were the ones from Senegambia. And right here where you have Sierra Leone, Guinea-Bissau, all in this area, because they knew how to cultivate rice. And the white man didn't know how to cultivate rice. So when they brought those slaves out, what is interesting, that 80% of these slaves were Muslim. Islam had spread all through this area. There were three great civilizations, and you read about them when you took your studies in African history, but most of you either forgot it or you don't see it as important today. It is very important. Brother Brian, do I have, you know, most of you know this sign right here. This is called a Sankofa bird. And the Sankofa bird is what goes against what they are advertising on television. Forget the past. But in the African tradition, it says in order to go forward in life, you must know your beginning. So you see a bird with its body going this way, but its head picking up an egg means that's the origin. And it means your roots, your beginning. You have to know that. That's what stabilizes you. And the white man knew that, so he never taught you about your past. Or he never taught you about your roots. He made you think that you were just on the plantation, you were a slave, and thank God that we found you in the trees of Africa and brought you to America. But you have to know your beginning. So I'm going to talk about this for a minute because this will tell you where we are today in America. So in this book, and it says it clearly, it doesn't hide it, it talks about the slaves that came from this whole area and the most choice slaves. Most people think that slavery was something random, just get anybody. But those of you, you live close, this is not far from Savannah, go to Savannah and tour Savannah because Savannah, they had industrial plantations. They had industrial slaves in Savannah. I toured Savannah, and I just wanted to see it. You know, I always heard about it. I had relatives that came from there, and they took me to a church where the Underground Railroad was. And Savannah talks about that. How many have been to Savannah and took the tour? There's one of the churches, I think it's the Third Baptist Church. The tour guide took me in the church. He was from Trinidad, and he was a preacher in Savannah. And when we went in the church, he said, the Africans built this church, the slaves. And he told me about the brick factories there where the slaves made bricks and the ironwork because the Nigerians were specialists in ironwork in the country of Nigeria. He talked about the fences. Then when we got in the church, he said, this is a church that the slaves built. And he said they even left their markings, their tribal markings, on the side of the pews in the church. So we go over and we look at it, and I kept looking at it. Now, he's got a crowd of people. He's a tour guide. And so the side, the markings that he called African markings, it looked like Arab. But I wasn't sure because I really don't read Arab. But I wasn't sure, but my son does. So I called my son over. I said, son, what does that look like to you? So he turned his head to the side. He said, that is just Bismillah in the name of Allah in the church. So it shows that the slaves that they had there were Muslim. Now, that happened once for me in Savannah, but also when I was in Brazil, I went to Bahia. And in Bahia, and I found this out from a white Portuguese. He said, you're a Muslim? He said, there's some churches in the Bahia that the Muslims built. They built the churches facing the east. In the interior of the church, it looks just like a mosque. Even where the preacher preaches, there were Catholic churches, even where they preach is like a minbar. A minbar is where the imam stands up to deliver the khutbah. This is in the churches in Bahia. And if you know the history of the slave revolts in Bahia, they were all led by Muslims. And you can read about them in a book, I'm going to quote a book again, called The Servants of Allah by Sylvia Duke. And in that book, they talk about the slave revolts in Bahia that was led by Muslims. And so my point I'm making is that you probably come from Muslim backgrounds, but you didn't know it. Remember, when you were brought here as a slave, the white man didn't let you have Christianity at first. You were just a slave. Then they came up with the idea that it would not be inconsistent for him to be a slave and a Christian. Just keep him out of the Old Testament. Let him lay in that New Testament, turn the other cheek, rob your coat, give him your pants, God forgive them for they know not what they do, you know, all of that. They wanted to give that to you, but not the Old Testament, but they let you become a Christian. So now, where are we at today with this? And I'm saying Malcolm was the great exponent of this when he was doing his autobiography with Alex Haley.
That's right.
And Malcolm hammered Alex Haley that you probably came from a Muslim family. Alex Haley rejected it. How many of the young people never heard of the book Roots? Raise your hand. It's all right. Never heard of the book Roots, okay? Some of you don't want to read it. That's right. It's all right. But it's a book that, and how many young sisters never heard of Roots? Never heard of the book Roots, okay? When Malcolm X, and I'm going to give you this little history so that you would notice, when Malcolm X helped a man named Alex Haley, who came out of the Coast Guard, to write a story that appeared in Reader's Digest in 1960 called The Most Powerful Black Man in America. And it was about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And the reason was that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was drawing these big crowds, 10 and 15,000 people, at the height of the civil rights struggle. And he was talking about we shouldn't try to integrate, but we should separate. And this was phenomenal to white America. So the article became one of the best read articles during that time in Reader's Digest. So when the article appeared and everybody was talking about it, Alex Haley came back to Malcolm and said to Malcolm that I'd like to write the biography of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And Malcolm took it to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, no, brother, my life is only written when a period is put to it. He said, however, Malcolm, why don't you let him write about your life so your life can be a testimony of the power of Islam? Remember, Malcolm was a thug. He was dealing in dope. He was a reefer smoker. He was running numbers. He was running women. And he got busted breaking in the house to satisfy his habit of drugs, and he went to jail. But it was Islam that redeemed him. So the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, tell him your story. And your story can be a testament of the power of Islam in your life. So that's how the book started, which nobody really talks about. Okay? They don't talk. Even the book, Brother Brian, do we have Manning's book back there on the table? Manning's book, and I'm not showing this to you because Manning's gotten you all in the book. Okay? When you read about Larry Foyx, that's me. Okay? But in this book, Manning's book, he doesn't go into the roots. Now, he's the last one that did an extensive study on Malcolm. The minister, when the minister read it, some of you remember the hookup that night. He said, I'm reading this book. He said, maybe you should read it. Now, we disagree with a lot of things in here, but Manning didn't spare anybody. He Marcus Garvey, all of the people who struggled with us, he basically kicked them under the bus, including the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And Minister Farrakhan gave him maybe 10 hours. I gave him 6 hours because he wanted to know, Brother James, where's Brother Kareem? Where's Kareem? Well, he wanted to know about New York City, and because Malcolm's base was in New York City. So he wanted to know about that, so we told him about it, but he did tremendous research. And even though my disagreement with him, I have to agree that he did the most extensive research on Malcolm's trip to Africa. There's nobody, there's facts about Malcolm's countries and the countries he went to and how it happened, and people that I know to this day, people that I met in Africa, that he did that kind of research. My point is that this is the beginnings of the Nation of Islam's impact on the black struggle in this country. And if you don't know that, as you talk to the young people, when you talk to them about Roots, let them read Roots. You read it with them, and that's the way you really get them. Or let them look at the video and show them the video of how we were brought to America, we were made slaves, how they changed our name. Some people say, well, I don't need to change my name. You don't have to change it, but it doesn't negate the fact that it is the slave master's name. Well, you didn't come from Africa with Jones and Johnson and Prescott and O'Reilly, O'Toole, O'Fool, whatever your name was, okay? But those are the white man's names that he gave. And so when people become enlightened, you say, well, why do you got this random African name? See how they downgrade that? See, and what you got an advantage of, you can have an African name or an Islamic name or an original name or an enlightened name, but you also got your slave name. And nobody can challenge you on which one you want to use. You can play it like a deck of cards. They can't challenge you on it because that's the name that you gave me. And when I choose the way that I can, and this is my African or my Muslim name, and I can wear that. And nobody, I've been through it, so they can't challenge you on that. As long as you don't have two Social Security numbers, and as long as you're not using it as a scheme to get credit in both names and all of that, but you can say, I'll choose what you call me. And the sisters are the ones who really helped this law to be passed, because a woman, once she's married and divorced, she can wear the name she wants. She can wear her ex-husband's name, or she can wear her maiden name, and it's not illegal. So I'm just saying that. Let me continue on this subject, on this point. And I'm going to try to be out of here soon. I know you say, well, if you talk about, you're very long-winded, okay? The other thing that we have to look at, this war on Islam is a genuine war because they're afraid of what Islam will do with black people in terms of them being enlightened. And one of our great weaknesses in our community is our inability to work and cooperate with each other. There's a little book called Robert's Rules of Order. Anybody know that book?
Yes, sir.
Now, sometimes it's hard for to organize things. Last night I was trying to encourage the people in Fort Pierce. A young man named James Anderson, 40 years old, was stopped because he didn't have a seatbelt on. It turned into something else. The police beat him real bad. He was in the jailhouse. The judge saw he was not responsive. They took him to the hospital, and he died. And see, now, how many don't know anything about it? Just raise your hand. You've never heard about it. See that? It was the brother, and I have to give Dr. White credit. When Trayvon Martin was killed, he was the one that was calling all over the country to national leaders to tell them that this young man was shot down. But what they have done, and they know they're scientists of war, they know that when struggle happens, people catch on and get the spirit of the struggle. And a classic example is the Civil Rights Movement. Because the news was so anxious to report this struggle, it went all over the country. And in cities, people begin to demonstrate. They begin to sit at lunch counters. They begin to agitate because it caught on fire. So in the new term, what he did is he isolated Florida, and the death of young black people in Florida is isolated from the rest of the country. The only one that hit national news that impacted the country is Trayvon Martin. It was so heavy that the president had to speak into it two times. And after he was this Zimmerman, who was a white boy, don't let him disguise, you know, he's a white boy, okay? Come on. Well, he's Hispanic, you know. With a name like Zimmerman, how is he Hispanic in the first place? And I don't see the thread of the black man in him. He's a white boy who killed a 17-year-old boy. But what happened, because it was a national, the president himself had to weigh into it on two occasions. So in the state of Florida, if young people are dying, and you just sitting home talking about it's a shame, and business as usual, you got to organize. Now, I don't necessarily go along completely with Robert's Rules of Order, But when you organize people, you got to have a rule of order. In the Nation of Islam, we can organize because we got rules and order, and people don't like it. But it's a discipline that we've accepted as Muslims in order for us to get something done. You know, if it's pure chaos and you don't respect nobody, then you can't get anything organized and done. You just can't do it. There has to be a level of respect so the white folks realize they had to codify it. You know, speaker, you got 3 minutes. After your 3 minutes, sit down and shut up, okay, and let the next person speak. Ideas hit the table, they evaluate it, and then you execute on something. Now, some people don't know that. The slave master never wanted to teach us how to organize because he knew that if you organized, you would revolt. The things that he kept you away was being analytical, and that's the greatest thing you can teach your children, how to analyze, how to study something. That's the greatest thing you can give to them. And then you have to have what is called critical thinking. You got to look at something. If something needs to be done, I'm going to give you an example. FYI, this is no inference on you because I do thank you for coming to Fort Pierce. But there were some women in the room unfolding the table. The church is lacking men. But that, it's a big church. We thank the pastor for allowing it. But if you notice the crew, how many was there with me the other night? Last night it was, okay? If you notice the crew of people that were taking the tables down and sweeping the floor were all women. And brothers were standing by. I don't know if you were going to post with me or not. You're standing by. And the women were taking the table. And one of the brothers had suggested, Brother Brian, it may have been you, suggested, why don't we help the sister? Now, that's what you call being analytical and looking at the circumstances. You didn't hear the captain say, brother, go help her take the table down. Okay? I mean, it's common sense. Okay? So the Nation of Islam has the ability to organize and move things. There's a spiritual leader at the center that we love and respect, and he has proven his integrity. We feel that Allah has blessed him. And then he puts out things that he wants to see the nation move on. And sometimes we wait. He puts it out. It's beautiful. We hold our hands up, yes, but we wait. Why don't we move out on what we have learned? The Honorable Elijah Muhammad laid out a blueprint for us. Minister Farrakhan picked it up. But we got to be proactive. I know this is a little away from the subject, but I got to tell you about it, okay? We have to be involved in the social issues that affect our community. And it's not only when they say, well, Brother James or Brother Michael, come to this rally because you're going to speak. And it can't be about speaking all the time. Come to the rally to show your support. When other people are having things, you got to go to it. You got to be there. They got to see the presence of the Muslim brothers, some of the Muslim mosques. Those under Imam Muhammad, those who are Sunni, Shiites, Ahmadis, whatever, all they know is that the Eid is coming up Tuesday. We'll all get together, thousands of us. We're going to pray Eid. This is the Eid after Hajj, okay? Eid al-Ahad. And we're going to pray the Eid. But they don't see us involved. They don't see us at no demonstrations or whatnot. Then someone said, well, we don't demonstrate. What does that mean, you don't demonstrate? I mean, what does it mean exactly? It means that anything happens in the community and we're trying to agitate white folks to treat our people better, we can't go out there because we Muslim. Or we don't vote because we're Muslim. We don't believe in this. Any Muslim in the Nation of Islam that says that, you're absolutely incorrect. I think, Brother Brian, do we have a picture of the minister registering to vote back there? Okay. When the minister Farrakhan registered to vote, when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad wrote in message to the black man, when you find a good politician, support him. You got to be actively involved because politics controls your life. So how you going to say I'm a Muslim, so all I'm waiting for Allah is to destroy the white man. I hope that I go to heaven. I'm going to make my prayers, and I'm going to fast during Ramadan. I'm going to make Hajj if I can, and I don't want to be bothered with nothing else in the world. You better wake up and smell the coffee, because this book that I just showed you that the white man is actively involved in your life. And that he's trying to destroy what is your belief system. He's trying to make it difficult for you to function in this society as a Muslim. So you have to be engaged. You have to show your people who really don't know. They don't know nothing about Islam. And then you got to make it complicated. I'm a Muslim and we do this and we do that. You're a Muslim, your belief is Islam, and the simplicity of Islam is this beauty. I'm going to give you another book to read, okay? And the way you read these books, one person don't have to read all these books. You do it like you do with the book club. Sister, you belong to book club. We just want to stop you from reading Zane and Waiting to Disappear and all of that. She Got Game, Ghetto Gold Digger, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. I want to give you some philosophy and opinion of Marcus Garvey, okay? And Stella Got Her Groove Back, okay? Matter of fact, Terman Miller just published a new book last week. Sisters, you know the name of it? But you don't have to. You can take a book. It's a book like this is a book. Okay, thank you. In the back, I have a book table. Let me just digress a minute. I'm selling off my library. And the reason that I'm selling off wherever I travel, as Brother Philip said, I know Akbar's in town because there's a box of books. But wherever I travel, I'm selling my library. And my philosophy for selling it off is that I got 10 beautiful children. I had 10. I lost one daughter. And I know that when I leave here, for 6 months to a year, they'll hold my stuff. It'll be, and I'm going to leave. Everybody's going to leave. Now,
right.
Okay? And they'll hold it a while, and then they'll do like Malcolm's daughter did with his stuff that was found here in the storage outside of Miami. All of his personal stuff, his books, his papers, his letters from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, they left it in the storage. And you know what we do. We can't pay the storage bill. And you know how much stuff. If you could count up the stuff that black folks have lost in storage, it would blow your mind, okay? You run on hard times. You can't pay the bill. Somebody comes through and buys. And so with my books, and I got a lot of books. And I know I got collector's items. And so I felt like this. I said, well, I might as well. I lecture. And I'll take my books with me wherever I go. I'll put a small price on them, and I'll sell them. Because there's a book that a Jewish man wrote. It says that you might as well fly first class on your money, because when you die, your children will fly first class, okay? So I might as well turn my books into liquid while I'm alive that will keep me traveling on the road. But I just want to mention that because there's some historical pictures. This is one of my pictures. This is Minister Farrakhan registering to vote. And there's Jesse Jackson standing over his shoulder, the brother who used to be the comptroller in the state of Illinois. There's Joshua. And here is the man who helped Barack Obama, the white boy that worked at Barack Obama. Does anybody know him from Chicago? I can't think of his name, but you see his picture, okay? Now, making the point I'm making, let me go back to my point if I can pick it up, is that these books that I'm saying, you don't have to read them as individuals. You can have a little small book club. You read 25 pages, she reads 25. You come together. They tell you what the 25 pages that I read. Then you have an overview of the books. There are a lot of books out there. Okay, just like during Ramadan, we read the Holy Quran every Ramadan. And we read the whole book, and some people wonder how to get through it because you're focused on it every day. And the Quran is broken down into 30 sections, so in 30 days you can read it. And if you fall behind, you got to catch up. But every year, some Muslims read it more, wait for a year, but they study their Quran continuously, and you should do that because it's a book that doesn't have any time, and it feeds you. And there's always, and if you be my witness, every time you read it, you learn something new. And you say, I saw that last year, but I didn't see it the way I see it this year. And it's a book that feeds you. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said it in these words, that when you get in trouble, and God knows as black folks in America, we all in trouble, okay? But when you get in trouble, nurse your Holy Quran. That's his word. So it's your book. It's the source of your wisdom. I'm going to talk about something about the Islamic world, and I'm going to try to close this down. Brother Brian, what time do we have right now? How long, Brother Michael, do we have the room? let me say this about the struggle of Islam. You know, when you were in your black studies class, you read about three great empires in West Africa, all of this area here. It started when the Muslims came out of Saudi Arabia, and the Muslims came out and they Egypt at that time was mainly Coptic Christian. Here's Saudi Arabia right here. Can you see that? And they moved across North Africa. That's through Egypt, what is Libya, parts of Tunisia, Algeria, and they came to Morocco. They met the Berbers in the field of battle, led by a woman. And you can read details in the Islamic history. And the woman said, if you beat me on the field of battle, I'll join your religion. Now, these were warriors. These weren't scholars and so forth. They defeated her. They joined the ranks. And among the ranks of those Berbers was a man named Tariq. They crossed into Spain right here at what is known today as Gibraltar. Gibraltar is actually the corruption of Mountain of Tariq in Arabic. The Muslims moved into Spain and occupied Spain for 800 years. And they tried to move into France, cross the Pyrenees. And a man named Charles Martel, or Charles the Hammer, he was known to stop the Muslims in the Pyrenees Mountains, and the Muslims built a great civilization, especially in southern Spain. I visited Granada, Seville, and the Muslims in Granada, there's still a huge mosque. It's a church today. And the Spanish people fight because Muslims who visit it want to make salat. They want to say a prayer in it because it was once a mosque, but the Spanish government refused it. Then the Arab Muslims moved down into West Africa, and they spread Islam. And in the book called The Preaching of Islam by Arnold, where he describes how Islam moved from what Indonesia in the Far East all the way to the shores of Morocco, Islam spread. But in the book, he describes how Islam captured certain areas, not just by the sword, as the Western world wants you to believe, but it was the beauty of the faith, the simplicity of the faith. One of the greatest stories in The Preaching of Islam by Arnold, a British man, is when they got to India, and the Genghis Khan's people came out of the east, and they were conquering. You know, they had a policy to burn everything, conquer everything, but they ran into the Muslims. They had the Muslims and the Hindus to argue with each other their faith. Explain it to me. Most of them, Khans, that you see among the Pakistanis and so forth, most of them, it comes from the Genghis Khan and their people. Yeah. But when they heard the argument of the Muslims, which was simplicity, the worship of one God, prayers, your belief system, your lifestyle, they accepted Islam. The Hindu was a little more complicated, you know. I mean, the many gods, and you can't explain it with that kind of simplicity. And so Islam spread. And when Islam spread into this area of West Africa, and most of you know this story if you studied any Islam, one of the leaders in the country of Mali, not just what you see here, but Mali stretched over this whole area. There were three great civilizations. There was Songhai, Mali, and anybody can tell me the third one? Ghana. See, the Ghana that you see here, this little country, that's just the name that at independence they chose after the great Ghana civilization that stretched over all of this area. One of the most prominent rulers that emerged at that time was a general or a king or leader named Mansa Musa. He was the one from what is called Mali, and he made a Hajj. And you have to, I know you can fact check me on this. It was 1434 or 1447. Brian, you have to fact check that because I get a pass because of my age. I can't remember the exact number. But he made a famous Hajj that all scholars write about, and he made this Hajj. He loaded so many elephants with gold. They crossed the Sahara Desert. They went to Cairo, Egypt. They inflated the Cairo gold market. They had so much gold. Then he made Hajj to Mecca. But when he got there, how he used his money was that he knew that there was no scholarship about Islam. They didn't have institution of learnings and building, so he paid for architects and scholars, and he brought them back to West Africa. That's how Timbuktu became the center of learning, Jenin and Goa in Mali. So he used that in order to build Islam in West Africa, and Islam spread over this whole area. The Ghana civilization, though it was ruled by Muslims, most of the people in the Ghana civilization were non-Muslims. They were traditional worshippers. So, and the reason that Akbar is talking about this, because this whole area here is where Muslims were, and many of the slaves that they don't tell you about that were brought to America were Muslims. In the history of South Carolina, I was at Esto Island. Is that the name of it? Esto, is that it? I went there with my family, my grandchildren. And while I was there, I read the history of South Carolina. And in it, it talks about the slaves that they brought off the coast. There's another book out that talks about this. When they were trying to study how Muslims inside of America become radicalized, mainly they're talking about the Pakistanis and the Arab community, but they had a man named Ahmed Akbar to do a research. And in his research, and the book is called Journey into America, that's one book he wrote, and the other one was Journey into Islam. He talked about the black people. I don't have a map of America. On the out islands off South Carolina, or all the way down to Brunswick, Georgia, and how these slaves, follow me, were put out there, but it was so hot, the mosquitoes and malaria, that the white man left them out there to grow the rice, and he retreated to the mainland. So they were able to hold on to their tradition. How many in this audience remember Daughters of the Dust? Okay, the picture, Daughters of the Dust, okay? But this is really about all of the Muslims that existed there. I want you to follow where I'm going with this. And they tried to practice their faith. In the book that I mentioned, Sylvia Duke, she talks about it. Things that they couldn't do. They couldn't get to Mecca to make Hajj. So they put in the middle of the church like a tree or a stump, and they all went around it. And in the church today, you call it shouting. You shout. And when they go, if you go and make Hajj or Umrah, anybody here made Hajj or Umrah? And if you try to kiss the black stone and it's hard to get there, you just throw your hands up. And that was translated into the church. So many of the slaves were Muslim, the bottom line. There's a magazine that was produced in May of 1963, the Horizon magazine. It was a hardcover magazine. And in that magazine, it talks about Muslims in America. They have a picture of Malcolm X and a picture of a real black brother from northern Nigeria. Because Nigeria, this country right here, all of the northern part of Nigeria is Muslim. This is where they're having a problem with Boko Haram. But the most important part about that magazine, it's out of existence now, is that they had a page where they said it was the Methodist Monthly, instructions on how to handle your Muslim slaves. And it even said what they were good for. They were good counselors, good overseers, and so forth. There's a film now. I don't know if it's turned into a book, but and you can get it on Netflix or you can order it. It's called Prince Among Slaves.
Yeah.
Do y'all know that one?
Yeah.
Okay. But this is a testimony of how many black people who were brought in the holds of slave ships were Muslim, but their religion was taken away from them. When they were beaten, Kunta Kinte, remember the part in Roots? Go back and look at it again. Now with a fresh mind. And that's right. They said he didn't want to take the name that they gave him. They gave him the name Toby, which is from Tobias, which is a Christian name. And he was trying to hold on to his name. And you saw, I think it was Fiddler, one of them said, say yes, say yes. That's where the tradition of if he hollers, let him go. You know, because the black slaves would take these tremendous beatings. And they felt that women hollered out and screamed in the birth of children, but men held the pain that they had because they were warriors. So the slaves learned how to call it shucking old master. They said, holler, man. Make it you a lot of pain. Maybe he'll lighten up on you. So, therefore, the slavery said that many were Muslims, but Islam was taken away. So that's why when some of these brothers and sisters, me at 18 years old, when I first heard Islam, and even though I've been through a lot of changes, it's like in my DNA. It's like in New York, it was the drug capital, heroin capital of the world in the black community in the 60s. And the heroin people, if their mother and father shot drugs, when they take their first hit of drugs, they say it was like something I've been looking for all of my life. They become a part of that drug culture. So it is with Islam. When they hear Islam and they get it into them, it's like something they've been looking for all of their life, something that changes them, something that strengthens them, something that gives them a new view on life. This is the power of Islam in your life. And you cannot deny that it has made you different. Even with the changes that you go through in the mosque, you get mad at the imam or the captain or the minister or the sister secretary or brother or lieutenant, but they can't drive you away from your Islam. And even if you're away from here, the fact that you say, I'm a Muslim, okay, I may not be in this masjid or that one, because Islam is a part of you. It resonates with your whole being, and it's what you've been looking for all of your life, because they brought you from that when they brought you out of Africa. I hope you follow me on that. Let me close this down. The jails in America. Now, this is a real problem. There's a new book out called Shackle and Chain, and it's about the jail system in America. And on this campaign against the religion of Islam, New York State started it. They realized the power of Islam in the jail system. And it's in jails that brothers have time and sisters have time to think. And they're looking for something that will keep them away from a world that has destroyed their life. The world of drugs, dysfunctional families, and the loss of jobs, and you know, violating loved ones and so forth. It's the world they came out of. But they found that in Islam, it gave them something to hold on and the power to deal with that world. So brothers in jail is where a lot of conversion takes place. And the system looks at it. In the state of New York, they implemented a way that when you said, if you say on the form, when you go in, they say, what's your religion? Some people put no religious preference. Some people put Islam. And the jails in the New York State prison system, they say, well, what group do you belong to? Are you a Shia? You're a Sunni? You're an Ahmadiyya? You're a 5%er? You're a Morris Science? You're a Nation of Islam? And once you say what you are, that's the group that you go to. They don't allow them. If you say that you come in as a Nation of Islam, they say, well, I want to go to Juma with the Sunni brothers. Well, I want to go to Juma or lecture with the Shia. You cannot go. And this is because they realize that in Islam, you have the ability to unite with your brothers, and the power of Islam, they can't do it. They're wrestling with how to handle Muslims in the Western world. This book right here that I showed Brother Imam Abdul Malik, my brother here who just came in, I was going through this book, and I was telling them about how they're setting up laws, and they would only set up laws for what they fear. In Switzerland, they passed a law, it's been 2 years now, that you cannot build any more minarets. You can't build them in Switzerland. Then they set laws that women cannot go into a building covered. They didn't say, you know, covered completely with a burqa, but just covered, your head covered. You got to take it off. So this is all against Islam. Minister Farrakhan said in the time and what must be done that France and Europe by 2050 would be dominated by Islam. In the Muslim world, when they wrote the book, Brother Brian, you gave it to me, Our Decline and Its Causes. Do I have it? I have to call Brother Brian. Is that book up? Is Brother Brian in here? Our Decline and Its Causes. The Muslim world analyzed that they had conquered the world. As I said, from Morocco to Indonesia, Islam, the movement of Columbus that my brother was talking about, Columbus was trying to find a new way. You know, Columbus was from Italy. And the Italians didn't believe what he was saying, that you could reach the east by sailing west. They didn't believe that. So he had to go to this country right here, Spain. And during the time that the Christians were fighting the Muslims, and in 1492, they had what is called the Inquisition, where the Christians defeated the Muslims. And most of the Muslims were driven out of Spain at that time. It was the same time that Columbus approached Isabel and Ferdinand. And being that his country would not finance him, he got the finance from them and convinced them that if he sailed west, he could reach the east. Why did they want to reach the east? Because in China and in India, it had everything that Europe needs, spices and riches. But the only way they could get there, they had to go overland to where this to Tajikistan. These countries over here, they had to go through all of that area. And if you remember your history, it was called the Silk Road. But the Silk Road, right? They never told you what it was about. They just said that it was an overland, difficult trip. They had to go through Muslim countries. And the Muslims were blocking them at every step because they saw them as people who were against their way of life. But they wanted to get to India. So Columbus, that's what it means in our lesson, he was half learned. Because he was so arrogant when he stumbled into a continent that he didn't even know existed, and he saw the people immediately called them Indians so he could justify that I had reached India. Isn't that arrogant? Okay. And then they say to you that he discovered America. How do you discover something which people already live? Okay. So therefore, what they wanted to do was to get to the east in order to do that, and they didn't want to go through this treacherous route. So now I'm saying all of this to say that Islam will become the power in the world. Now, I know people don't like to hear that, but we are tolerant. We tolerate because in our book, the Holy Quran, it says that the people, you respect their houses of worship among the Yahudis or the Jews and the Christians, okay? You respect them. And they have their way and we have our way. Their belief is not our belief. But Islam will dominate the world because the beauty and the simplicity of the faith and its power in the life of the individual. Now, many of the brothers in the black liberation struggle, if you look at them, even those who are political prisoners this day, they have Muslim names. Now, they didn't know when they went to Tanzania in 1974 and 69, and Julius Nyerere was the president, and they took those names, Haki Madhubuti, Malena Karinga. They didn't realize that all of them were Muslim names. It's like Barack Obama, Barack, and I can ask my brother, blessing. It comes from the Arabic word blessing. And the Muslims who came out of, see this country right here, Yemen and Oman, these Muslims sailed down the coast, East African coast. And then they went inland. And that book that I mentioned to you, Preaching of Islam by Arnold, is a beautiful story about the Muslims went inland to Uganda. And Uganda is a country right here where Minister Farrakhan and I were there in 77 with Idi Amin. And you'll see on the table in the back a picture of Idi Amin, myself, and Minister Farrakhan sitting there. But Islam spread into Uganda. It was the people from Yemen and Oman that came down the east coast of Africa, went into the interior, and spread Islam. And in the Preaching of Islam by Arnold, the Muslims took prisoner one of the indigenous black people, and they took him all the way to Syria. And when he went to Syria, now, as a slave, he converted to Islam. And the tradition among the Muslims was that if they convert, they give them some freedom. He got his freedom in Syria and made his way back to Uganda. And they talk about the same sea captains came back. And when he saw them and greeted them, you read the story, a lot of details in the book. He said, then why didn't you tell me when you came about the beauty of Islam? I thought it was an unbelievable story in the Preaching of Islam. A white British man wrote this, and he takes countries throughout the world where Islam has spread. So we are in a challenge. Some of the nationalist brothers, their spirit, the struggle, their spirit to get involved came from the roots of Islam. So if you go and look at the political prisoners, all of them got just about every one of them have a Muslim name. So this is the power of Islam, and what do we do with it now? How do we use that power? How do we leverage the power of the discipline that we have? Because the blessing is that you are not victimized by the things of the Western world. There's they string you out on more than drugs and Molly and reefer and all of that. There's a book that just came out. I tell you, it's not a library class, but I got to do that.
Go ahead.
It's called Salt, Sugar, and Fats. Now, do we have a How to Eat to Live up here, Brian? Is there one up here? Can I get? We don't have that copy, okay? Somebody, I had a copy of How to Eat to Live. Now, some people look at How to Eat to Live. Do we have one here at all? Do we have any How to Eat to Live here? Maybe that's the problem. We not really, you need to review. We did have one with us, though, didn't we, Brian? And we sold it. Somebody begged me for it, and it's what we call, I wasn't going to sell it, it's my props. And somebody begged me for a copy, so I went on and sold it, okay? But this book just came out. And what's fascinating, the first chapter, I haven't read the whole book, but these corporations sit down and determine how they're going to get you strung out on salt. You ever had one of those salt that you have it all the time when you get those potato chips, okay? You're not buying it for the potatoes. You're buying it for the salt that's on those potatoes. It's a salt habit. I get it myself sometimes. Give me a pretzel or two, you understand? And then sugar, you definitely strung out on that, okay? You have to develop a strong willpower to drink your tea and coffee without sugar. Because you're so strung out on that sugar, and then after you eat a meal, and I'm talking to myself too, I don't feel that the meal is complete unless I down one of them bean pies, okay? So you have a sugar habit, and don't mention fats. I used to say to the brothers that the same substance that they put in the crack cocaine that the brothers get strung out, it must be sprinkling in French fries. I mean, so everybody has this little French fry habit, okay? But they plan this. And then they have the audacity to write about what they plan. And you become victims of what they plan. So Islam is to give you discipline in all of your life. And with my brother Imam here, I want to say this. One of the greatest disciplines in Islam is prayer. Because you can't say I'm a Muslim and don't pray. You can't say a Muslim and I'm independent of God. I believe, but I just don't have time to make prayer. And that's why it's so beautiful in the morning call to prayer. It says, for surely prayer is better than sleep. See, that should be the power to get you up out of the bed. Now, remember this. I haven't read in no hadith. It's definitely not in the Quran. that after you make your prayers, you can't go back to sleep, okay? So get up, make your prayers, and if you still worn out, go back to sleep and get some sleep. But this is what you have to do as a Muslim, okay? So the discipline of Islam is the beauty of your life. That is the beauty, the discipline that you learn, your belief, and keep God with you. I told a young man that's speaking in the Daytona Beach today. He's 13 years old. I said, remember, when you step up to speak, call on Allah. Ask Allah to guide your words. Anybody that feel that they can go before people, every time I come up to speak,
that's
and I've been doing this for 50 years of my life, I call on Allah.
That's right.
I ask Allah to guide my words, you know, guide my feet, my steps. And so that's why Muslims say if there's any mistake, then blame it on my head, not my heart. Because my heart was in the right place, but I may have made a mistake by you. So I'm going to close this out. And I want to say to the brothers and sisters who have come out for the first, second time, that believe me, yes, we do proselytize. Of the three great faiths, only two proselytize. We call it da'wah. In the Nation of Islam, we call it fishing. The Christians call it proselytizing. But have you ever seen a Jew on the corner telling you to come to the synagogue? You ever seen a Jew said, accept Judaism, you know, and trying to get you to come? They don't do it. They don't proselytize. But Christianity and Islam, we do proselytize. And the proselytizing is not for you to see the world the way we see it. The proselytizing is because we're reaching for the soul of a black man or a black woman who may be lost in the world, who may be having problems. And we're saying we want to introduce you to the beauty of this faith called Islam. Thank you. May Allah bless you. As-salamu alaykum. Thank you. Allahu Akbar. Thank you very much. Thank you. Brothers and sisters, there was a note that I made, and I want to share this with you. And traveling is probably one of the greatest things that happened to me because when Minister Farrakhan sent me to Africa and I moved to Ghana, I really didn't know what I was going to do. I knew I could not do what I was doing in America as a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Ghana is about 72% Muslim. These brothers and sisters were born in Islam. But what I found out, they were Muslim because their mother and father were Muslim, but they hadn't studied the faith. They didn't know aspects of the faith. They just were Muslims and trying to be the best Muslims they could with their malams and their teachers. But what I realized when I was there was that there had to be a way that you could approach them with what we've learned in the Western world. And we've learned something. It's all exposure in the Western world, how to get things done, how to build and use the skills. But when white people taught us, they first called our institutions, they call them training schools for Negroes. So you train a horse, you train your cattle, you train your dog and your cat. But human beings are educated, okay? So when you train the dog or the cat or your horse, they don't have the power of reasoning. They operate off instinct based on what you train them to do. But a human being has the power of reasoning, and that's what we're saying to you. And your reasoning power allows you to put things on scale to say yes or no. Sisters, when you meet a man, you put him on a scale, and you say yes, he's trying to gain access to you. If you have a principle that you believe in and live by, you can say no easy. But if you don't have no principle that you live by and a standard that you develop for yourself, then you open that door for him. And he may not be the best man for you. But if you live by a principle, then it's easy for you to close that door. And it's the same thing with you, brother. You know, I mean, access to women. So there has to be a knowledge and a belief system within your life that strengthens you. This is what I learned from the minister. And the minister is heavy on teaching about the discipline of a Muslim. You know, there are certain things in Islam and it's growth. You can't learn everything overnight. You can't, you're a baby in the faith, you can't start eating steaks. Baby starts with milk, then strained food, and then whole food. And it's a lesson in life about anything that you want to learn that's going to be a part of what you are. So I want to thank you very much. When I was in New Zealand, New Zealand is a fascinating place. They have a group called Māoris. They call themselves black people. when Cook discovered New Zealand, they said that by 1845, they predicted that the Maoris would be wiped out. They would wipe them out. And they went after it, you know, just as the Americans tried to wipe out the Indians with smallpox blankets. And you need to read that history really to understand it. When they spread syphilis that Minister Farrakhan talked about in their experiment in Tuskegee among our people. So they're always with this kind of death wish for people that they can experiment on. The jails are a prime example in this country. But when I was there in New Zealand, the jail population was mainly the Maoris. They were in jail. They were abusers of alcohol. The young boys, they didn't have the kind of drugs you have in America, but they put glue in brown paper bags, and they make a little opening, and they sniff it, and that's how they get high. So this lawyer, who was like what you would call a public defender, to help the young men, he said, I didn't know what to do with him. He said, so after I read Malcolm X's book, and when he read Malcolm X's book where it mentions Akbar Muhammad in the book, he thought it was me. I had to tell him, no, that's the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And then he said what he did, he didn't know what to do with him, so he gave him Malcolm X's autobiography. And even though it's a book, if you read the book, up until the time of Malcolm's death, Alex Haley finished the book, and that's where the book takes a turn. But the whole first part of that book is excellent, and it has brought thousands of young men and women to the Nation of Islam. Okay, that Alex Haley writes against us in the end, but when you walk through Malcolm's life, where he came from, and Malcolm has impacted the entire world, almost like Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali is a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Brother Brian, do we have that Muhammad Ali book? I was looking at it. They produced a beautiful book on Muhammad Ali. And what surprised me, Muhammad Ali's opposition to the Vietnam War, it's a big book with Muhammad Ali's picture on the front. It's a children's book. And they put that part in there. And what is important about it, he stood on a principle as a Muslim. And he invoked the name. How many saw the HBO, The Trials of Muhammad Ali on television? If you didn't see it, you know, make sure that you see it, because it is a good piece. I don't know who put it together. They got in the books, the judge got message to the black man on his desk, okay? Then he reaches on the shelf and takes out the Holy Quran, and he's defending Muhammad Ali's position as a Muslim. It's an unbelievable piece. It's on HBO, and I know in many of your homes you don't want HBO because of the children, but you can exercise control. And you are right. You got to hold their minds. You got to guard their minds, because that garbage on television is unbelievable. And then you go to late nights or adult only, and you ain't got no monitor. You out somewhere, and your children looking at that stuff. That stuff goes in their brain, and it bends their mind. See, and the kind of stuff they show, they can never forget. So you got to guard the minds of your children. Don't be so liberal because you like to look at it, and you let your children have access to it, okay? So, but if you look at this piece on Muhammad Ali, I was impressed. First, I wasn't going to look at it. Brother said, why don't you turn it on? You need to look at this. And when I saw that message to the black man laying on his desk, that's promotion for the book. But then he turned around on his bookshelf behind him. He reached and pulled out a Holy Quran, okay? And it was like a signal showing something. And the Holy Quran, it's a source book for the Western world to look at how Muslims believe. And they can't figure Muslims out, because it's not something that you can just take away from their faith and their dedication. Even with these suicide bombings that we don't go along with, because in the history of Islam, in the tradition of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, told them, you know, children, women, and old people, forbidden. You don't, in warfare, you save their lives. You don't go and kill them. And these suicide bombings just kill people generally, mm-hmm. which is wrong. Muslims do not do that. And so the Western world said, well, what causes them to do this? It's like cornering. You ever looked at a possum or a raccoon and you corner them or try to mess with their children? I mean, they go for it. You cannot frighten them. You can stomp the floor and all of that, but they will attack you. And so the people feel cornered, and this is the result of them being cornered by what the Western world is trying to do to Islam. So in New Zealand, that lawyer would give him the book, and he said he found that when these young boys read the life of Malcolm, it changed many of them, because they were looking at somebody who was in criminal activity. The Islam, they had nobody to teach Islam in New Zealand at the time. They just didn't have it. But he knew that that book and the life of Malcolm had a tremendous impact. So I'm going to close it out. I'm going to open the floor. We're going to take what time is it now? Brother Brian had to go do a radio show for me in Boston because we started a little late, and the radio show comes on at 1:30. So Brian is taking care of that show so I can finish this up. I'm going to open up the floor and take a few questions. And then
you understand that the lines are full, so they may have questions too. So what I'd like to do is take the phone, plug it back into the computer, and then this way, if there are any questions from the laptop audience, they can also pose those to these questions.
Excellent. Thank you. I saw your hand first, my sister.
As always, this is for appreciation for your presentation. It's really impactful and really great. I appreciate the history because I feel like that's the thing that we've been robbed of. And I've been in political activity for 13 years, and every day I still learn something new about our history. And so I just really appreciated the presentation. In terms of the discussion about the attack on the Muslim world, with what's happening right now, I'm really kind of just looking more for your insight about what's happening with this conflict with Syria and also this most recent event that took place in Nairobi, Kenya. It's my understanding that aside, one of the things that signaled him out is the fact that he is, on the one hand, openly opposed to Israel and is also openly supportive of the aspirations of the Palestinian people to regain control of their land and end the genocide against the Palestinians. And you talk a lot about the differences in, like, between the Nation of Islam, Black Muslims, and, like, Sunnis and Arabs and what have you. In terms of how Black people should be moving in this country, like, political positions that I, you know, that I came from, the organization that I came from, no longer part of, was generally, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and how is it that, you know, even if we have political or ideological differences, how do we express solidarity with people who are being openly attacked by U.S. imperialism, you know, despite the difference, despite you think, political and ideological differences? Because one of the things that I've seen, and you mentioned it briefly, was I've participated in a lot of pro-Palestinian demonstrations and what have you, especially when a few years ago, maybe about 7 years ago, when Israel was bombing Palestine, you didn't see emergence of just the complete Muslim population, despite whatever, you know, religious differences exist between Arabs and Black Muslims. And I've been to Palestine, pro-Palestinian demonstrations that have been upwards of 2,000 people right here in Florida, and we would be, as political organizers, the only Black people there, five or six of us coming from political organizations. So I just was kind of wondering, you know, what your position was on that and how Black people can organize in solidarity against the attacks against Syria and the coming attacks that are happening in Africa. The fact that, and, you know, I don't know how everybody feels, but I personally am politically completely opposed to Obama. I think that he is a neo-colonial agent. I think he is a willing participant of imperialism. I don't think he's been duped. I don't think he is ill-informed. He is a very brilliant man. And he is responsible for establishing, giving AFRICOM a stronghold in Africa. So even this attack that America is about to make on Syria is just opening up the roads for America to have roots, solid roots in Africa. I think that's what that thing in Kenya is about. What's happening in Egypt is about. It's for America to reestablish a stronghold and easy access to the resources of our homeland.
Very good. Thank you, sir. I'm going to take four of your points. You made six. First, let me just start with Syria. I've been blessed to go to Syria, I believe, about six times. And the father of Bashar al-Assad, Hafiz al-Assad, was a very strong supporter of the Palestinian struggle. What entrenched him in that
was in the 67 war when the Israelis took the Golan Heights that really belonged to Assyria. And he gave the base of the Syrian, of the Palestinian strugglers, the strong one, Abu Musa and Dal and the rest of it, they had a base in Syria. And Syria is a very strong country. And what people don't realize that the richness of Syria and the power of their money is gas and oil that is really never talked about.
That's right.
The very fact that Bashar Assad's father negotiated on the meaning of the word terrorist, because the Jews took that word so that when you use it, you immediately think of an Arab.
Yes.
When you say terrorist, you don't think of Timothy McVeigh.
That's right.
You don't think of these right-wing terrorists in America.
That's right.
Or you don't think of Waco, Texas, and the guy down there, but you immediately think of Arabs. And it was his father who fought this designation. He said, and because people struggle for their independence, they should not be considered terrorists.
That's right.
That's one point.
Yeah.
The other point that you made about Barack Obama. Now, you know, I have hope in Barack Obama. Even
okay, Brother Kareem. Brother Kareem.
Yes, ma'am. I'm still here.
Okay, they are muted.
Huh?
They are muted us, so we can ask the listening audience if they have questions to get them ready now. So, do we have any questions?
No, ma'am, we don't. Not at this point. Not in the chat room or on the board.
Okay, so let me inform the listening audience that Student Minister Akbar is about to take questions. So if you have questions, press 1 on your dial pad. Those of you who are in the chat room, if you have a question, please type it in, and we will ask it on your behalf. Okay, thank you.
We got political critics, brothers that during the 60s struggled with them.
been rotten in this jail.
One of them just died. He was 71 years old. And there's others. All you got to do is to line up for political prisoners. But if we as black people don't send letters to him, because as the president, he can pardon people. Bill Clinton pardoned a whole group of them. That guy, Rich and whatnot, you know, he pardoned. Jesse Jackson couldn't get his brother pardoned. Bill Clinton didn't do it, but he pardoned all those white boys.
Yeah.
Jesse Jackson's brother, Noel, is in prison in South Carolina for life because they say he was involved with these young gang members in Chicago who put a hit on someone. But he can be pardoned. So we want all of our political prisoners pardoned because these brothers were in a liberation struggle for our freedom, and they gave them 50 and 60 and 75 years in jail at the age of 30 years old. You know, and then there's the agent in prison. When a man is no longer a threat to society, why would you just leave him in there to rot and die? When you can bring him out and be with his family, he's not going to stick up no more banks. He ain't going to shoot no more white boys, okay? So you could let him out. So if we as a black community would organize, and if he gets a million letters that you a black man and there are black people who are suffering in prison because they engaged in the liberation struggle in the way that they saw fit at the time because of the way black people suffered in America. So I wanted to mention that. Now, let me go to Africa, because this is my heart and soul, my sister. Yes, AFRICOM, that's the African Command, because Africa now with 950 million people, almost 1 billion people, but it is the richest continent in the world, and it's the future of the Western world. The only one that can compete with Africa is Russia, and Russia has all of the things that Africa has that the Western world needs. Most people don't know that in the richest piece of real estate almost in the world, but on the African continent, is the Democratic Republic of the Congo, formerly known as Zaire. And in the eastern part of Zaire, there's a product that they're fighting over right now. Anybody know what that product is? No. Coltan that makes the cell phone. The biggest business in the world right now is cell phone. Most people got two or three of them. In the old days, everybody was lucky to have one, okay? But you can't have a cell phone without coltan, and the biggest supply in the world is right here in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. But the other part, sister, is AFRICOM is here because they made a mess out of the Middle East. In the streets, they use another word to say they did something up the Middle East, okay? You all know that word, okay? So, and it was under Bush 1 and 2. So the Middle East is in shambles. They're fighting and killing each other, just like my subject. And they need the oil. America, as I describe it, is an oil junkie, always looking for the next hit. But there's so much chaos here that they need another supply of oil. Right here on the west coast of Africa, starting from Guinea-Bissau, where they're pumping it, it's probably in Senegal, all the way down this coast, there's tremendous oil. Ghana just started pumping into oil. You go to Nigeria, it has one of the finest oil. The two places in Africa that has the best oil in the world. Can anybody name those two countries?
Nigeria and Sudan.
No, Nigeria and Libya. So that's why they wanted to knock off Gaddafi, because he was a thorn in their side. Now they can't even pump oil. Libya is a failed state. Libya, right now, the oil is down to nothing. They just went in there and went right into Tripoli and pulled out somebody. The eastern part of Libya is at war with the western part of Libya. And today, my brother mentioned the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal talks about Libya. They have safe Gaddafi's son. And the only reason they have not killed him, because Libya, at the time that Gaddafi was overthrown, was reported to have $476 billion in sovereign wealth, independent wealth, in gold, hard currency, meaning foreign currency, and other wealth that Libya was in the possession of. They had no debt or anything. So these two countries have the best oil. So America says that if we have messed up the Middle East, and they're waiting to kick Saudi under the bus, but they can't kick Saudi under the bus until they get another supply of oil, because they have written and said openly that among the Wahhabis, as they call them, or Salafis, in Saudi Arabia after Abdul Wahhab, Abdul Wahab, okay, and that the Saudis produce what they call the extremist Muslims throughout the world. 15 of the 19 hijackers, if it is a fact about 9/11, came from Saudi Arabia. So they got a problem with Saudi, but they have to maintain this relationship because it's in their strategic interest. And Saudi is very well. But if we kick Saudi under the bus because of 9/11, then where's that supply of oil that they feed to us coming from? The next source, they thought it was going to be Iraq. That's why they knocked off Saddam Hussein. But that turned out to be a fiasco. They're killing each other every day in Iraq. So they said the next spot is Africa. They just found a big oil hit in Mali. They found one in Uganda. Oil all over Africa. And they want it for the Western world. So my sister, you said it right. They set up the African Command. That means there's bases all over Africa run by America. In this country, Somalia, and you've been hearing all about it, it's a failed state. In the Middle East, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Taliban means the student. Over here, Al-Shabaab in Somalia means the youth, and the Arabic word. Now, these Somalians, you say, well, what's all this about Somalia? This picture that you're going to go to the movie to see called Captain Phil?
Yeah. Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks. What's the name of the picture?
Captain
Phil. I want you to, if you go to the movie, or go see it, or if you do bootleg copies in the street, but make sure you see it, okay? And but the picture is showing you a white captain and black men.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. I don't care how you slice it. See, some of you don't see, they're just Somalians, but they're black men and Africans.
Yeah.
But then you say, well, why are these pirates hijacking the ship? Because all of them were fishermen.
Yeah.
That's why they know the ocean so well.
Yeah.
But because of what happened in this area, they drove their fishing grounds away. They have no way of making money.
Why?
Then they overthrew in 1991 the leader of this country, Siad Barre. And he was a man that went between Russia and America during the Cold War. And finally, when America found Chevron oil,
yes, sir.
And here's how you can fact check what Akbar is saying. Go and Google Chevron and oil in Somalia. When the black helicopter went down and so forth, you thought that they were in there trying to save the Somalian people because they were having food and all of that. They were there to protect Chevron and the oil that was found there. When Chevron found the oil in Somalia, they capped all of the wells to save it for a time because it has the longest sea coast in all of Africa. This is the country of Somalia right here. And they capped those wells because of the strategic position and used it at the right time because it's right here. At the Red Sea and come right through the Suez Canal and sail out. And if problem in the Suez Canal, they can always go south around the Horn of Africa and bring it to America. So they were holding it. That's why Chevron paid for everything that was happening there. And then when that helicopter went down and they saw Americans being dragged through the streets of Somalia and killed, America pulled out of there. But they kept the country in complete chaos all of these years. And when the Islamic courts, who were the predecessors to Al-Shabaab, came in, opened the airport, opened schools, began to rebuild the roads and whatnot, they didn't like that because they were Islamic. They called them Islamic fundamentalists. And so they wanted them out, and they encouraged Uganda first, under the guise of the African Union, to go in. Uganda went in, and after they went in and started killing and whatnot, the Al-Shabaab or the Somalians got into Kampala, set off a bomb in the middle of a conference there. And then Uganda pulled out. Kenya, that has a border with them, and this is important because in the day that Wall Street Journal that you picked up, there's an article in there and there's three copies downstairs. It says that it is interesting that they have not found one body of the Al-Shabaab people who raided that border. This is what it says in the paper now. They're either lying, they haven't found nobody. And so that was not something that just spontaneously happened because Kenya sent troops in. And the troops that Kenya sent in trying to crush Al-Shabaab, the troops killed children, women, and old people. And so they said they were going to get back at the Kenyans, and this was a part of what happened. So I'm just giving you this. So Africa now is in the spotlight of the Western world because the future of the Western world will depend on the continent that they pulled us out for their survival with the slaves and now the natural resources that are found all over Africa. I want to just say one more thing if my light is working. There's a country down here called Zimbabwe. And you remember how they were beating up on Robert Mugabe?
Yeah,
he was terrible.
Yeah.
He was dead. You say, well, did he change? He has been in the newspaper. What they found in Zimbabwe is they found diamonds and gold right under one another, and a lot of it. And so the Western world wants that. So Mugabe, if they say 87, some say 83, they say, well, we better just leave him alone and let the evil accident of time take him out of here. And then maybe we can get it. But right now, with the amount of diamonds and gold that they just discovered in Zimbabwe, so, you know, it's a hands-off policy. And you have to ask, why did the press just light up on him? No, they don't want to mess with him because he will cut off the selling of those diamonds and gold, and he has a tremendous supply. But I just wanted to go around, sister, you had a couple more things, the Palestinian question. And the reason that our people in Palestine, and I've been there four times, I've been to Jerusalem, and the reason that our people don't demonstrate and support them and whatnot, because they don't know. Apartheid exists in Palestine. When we went to Gaza, there was the Palestinian road and there was the Israeli road.
Yes.
If you didn't have an Israeli license plate on the vehicle you were in, you had to go on the Palestinian road. That was the worst road you could find.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're trying to make the children that are born to the Palestinians, they have Israeli passports. But they took their land. And then they used God's name to say,
yes,
this is the land God gave us.
Yes, right.
And that's why we have taken this land from these Palestinian people, and they are suffering. And plus, most of the Palestinians, even though there's a lot of Christian Palestinians, but most of them are Muslims, okay? I'm going to take I know that was a long answer. I got one, two. Any more questions? I got two. I got three. These will be the last three questions, okay? I want to start my brother. Yeah.
I
say
something very important, that the Christians and the Jews were out of the not the Jews, but, you know, only one half of 1% Jews are incarcerated because they know it is.
Mm-hmm.
And other night,
he's saying that, let me get you right. In Africa, you're an elder, and the kings always have a linguist. You talk to the linguist. The linguist speaks to people. So I'm going to say, he's saying that in prison, there's a small percentage of Jews in prison. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. And last friend I had, 11 Lutherans in my class on the 250 field. But anyway, I asked, how many of you were born into income? Only one. So I said, why is it? And I asked the other chair, when they get out of prison, I said, we don't have a way to get to foreign tax prison. Because most of them don't know the real history of income. So, and we're teaching on this, how to save our youth. And but the adults will be a role model for the youth. So how can we, as a people, help the young people?
I'm going to answer you two ways. Good, excellent question. First of all, they have what is called halfway house. We could open up a group of them called whole house. We could black men on the whole family. Okay? But they have laws. You can open it up. It's going to take rocket science. You ain't got to have a PhD to open up a halfway house. All you got to do is qualify by the state. And those young brothers that come out, if you can get them in your hands and have them in a place that will encourage them, will teach them some of the things that you're talking about. But we have to do that at all. We can't stand around and complain that the white man ain't doing this. You have the power with the laws that he set up
right,
to make himself successful. See, I have a philosophical view. When I see a white man, I was down in one of the cities down Florida, I saw this young white guy, he looked fairly tough. He's out there talking about he's homeless and begging. America was made for the white man to be successful. That's how it was made. And if he's a failure, that's on him. And you say, well, that sounds a little racist. No, that's the reality of life in America. So you have the ability to open up a halfway house. The prison system, and I don't have time to talk about it today, but the prison system is worth billions of dollars. Billions. And when you read the book Cocaine Nation, you'll see that the prisons were not filled. In 73, they were going to close down prisons. But right after that, it was the growth of crack cocaine. And that was a political decision on crack cocaine. And the Sandinistas were fighting the Contras in Nicaragua and so forth. Reagan was supporting the Contras. And the Senate and the Congress voted against the U.S. government giving any more money to the Contras, so they went to Prince Bandar. Prince Bonda gave him $32 million to support the Contras, and then the Contras went into the cocaine business. They found a highly addictive, cheap cocaine that became known as crack cocaine. And then nobody knew exactly what it was until Lynn Byers died.
Right.
And then the whole country knew about this crack cocaine. And then it started with a brother, Rick Ross. And I met with Rick a lot of times when he got out of prison. I read about him. And Rick said he wasn't politically astute. He didn't know this was political. All he knew, he could make some money, and these Spanish boys were supplying. The CIA was taking shiploads or plane loads of guns to Nicaragua, and they were loading it with cocaine to come back, and they produced in the labs this highly addictive, very inexpensive cocaine called crack, and it devastated the black community. A whole city collapsed under the weight of it, Baltimore, Maryland.
That's right.
And so what I'm saying is that we have the ability to save these young people, but you must be engaged. You can't sit in your church or your mosque on the corner. Look at the churches in our city. The churches are the place where ministers can organize and impact the community and the Nation of Islam and our mosques and the mosques of all of these Muslim communities can impact. But we got to go to work. We got to organize. We got to make it happen. You can't sit around. Some people sit there, I ain't going to do nothing because Allah can destroy you set up on the way to the ministry, God? Okay, so this is the last two questions, okay? Right here, these two, yes.
I'm looking. I first want to extend my sincere gratitude. I went to one of your lectures about maybe 10 years ago, and you opened my eyes up to the opportunities in Ghana. I've been traveling back and forth to Ghana. I have a business now in Ghana. We have an office there now. We have an exclusive dealership license to import motors. And I would like to talk to you about it a little bit more in detail to provide you with some things that we need help with. It's a little small company. And I'll be leaving in another 2 weeks for our third trip, and we're actually importing those motors, a second batch, into Ghana. So I know you're traveling, but I wanted to see if I had an opportunity to speak for you traveling before I leave for back to Ghana.
Well, inshallah, I'm leaving on the 23rd or the 24th this month. I'll only be there 7 days. The president is here. He gave me an appointment for some business that we're trying to do in Ghana. So I'm going to take advantage of that. And are you in our car?
Yes.
Okay, so after the meeting, you meet me in the back, and we'll go and talk to you. Thank you. And I'm glad that you stood up there as a testimony. Sister Paulette, she's a testimony. And if I can just do that, I encourage her to travel. She's going to Bora Bora. And I want to say with your children, teach them the art. So, you know, I'm talking about the map now. You know, I know that I'm good at Africa because I lived there for 15 years and I love contemporary African history. And I also know the map. I've been to 44 of those 54 countries in Africa. But your children must learn geography and give them a leaning towards history, okay? Because you got to know what was in order to understand what is and make an intelligent projection on what will be, okay? So that's the importance of it. But thank you, brother. That helps me. It means that all my words didn't just fall. Thank you very much. I'm encouraged.
Brother
okay.
Minister, before I question you, we have a question for the Blog Talk audience.
Yes.
Is that okay? Brother Kareem, are you there? Brother
yes,
Kareem.
Sir. As-salamu alaykum. Yes, sir.
Walaykum salam. Wa alaykum salam. We can hear you.
Yes, sir. You can hear me? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Well,
you can.
Yes, sir. I do have a question. It's a very quick question, and it's based upon, I want to thank Mr. Akbar for what he said. Also, the question very quickly is this, is as Muslims, what can we do to break down these barriers? I mean, what actions can we take? You mentioned some things, but what more actions can we take to break down these barriers that are keeping us from actually sharing this wisdom that we've gotten from the Quran and the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad and now continue to receive from the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan so we can go ahead on and resurrect the dead and get this job done?
Okay, thank you. And thank you for a short question and not a long statement. Thank you very much, my brother. The first thing, we got to be engaged. And I'm going to tell you, go right to the bottom line. You got to be active in the community of the people, that we feel that God has sent us after.
That's right.
But if you're not engaged, then there's no way you can break down barriers. They have to know you. They have to know the beauty of your faith. They have to know what you believe in. They have to know something about how it's changed you as a man or a woman and the power of Islam in your life. But you got to engage them. You have to be a person who looks at the social activities in your community and what the community is challenged with and step in there. You know, and everybody, if Brother Imam will use you because you're here, he's a religious leader in Islam. And his work is the study of the faith. But everybody can't be an imam. You may be a doctor, lawyer, an engineer, or something else. There may be another pursuit that you have as a teacher of history or biology.
Right.
So wherever you can engage your people, you have to be involved. And you have to take the biggest problems that we have. Why can't the Muslim community, all different Muslim communities, hire buses that on every Saturday or once a month, we will take families that have men and women in prisons, and we sponsor the bus to take them to the prison. And they send these brothers and sisters a long way off from home. Jamil Al-Amin is all the way out in Colorado. You got to buy a plane and then take another plane and then a bus in order to go see him, and that's a source of punishment. New York State, and I'm talking about a state I know, if you live in New York City and they send your son or your daughter to Dannemora, Dannemora is right near the Canadian border. It takes 6.5 hours, maybe 7, to get there, and they can't afford the bus fare, so they can't go see them. But if you, as the Muslim community, sponsor 5 buses to take families in the inner city to see their children, that's a small thing that we can do. And then people see us as concerned with them and a part of it. Muslims are fed not just during Ramadan, but once a month the Muslims have a feeding program where people can come and get food and the Muslims put their money together and feed them. Okay? Muslims have a tutoring service and a mentoring service for young black men who are being raised by single mothers and she needs a man in their life. Muslims are doing it. And they're not doing it. The Shiites are only doing it. This is the Nation of Islam. But collectively as Muslims, if we do that, we can impact the society. Thank you very much for your question, brother.
Thank you, brother. Thank you, brother. What is the impact in the cultural movement in Africa? I see a lot of the rap community industry in America is promoting this gay culture. What is their agenda in promoting the gay bomb in many of the African countries and how they're responding? And I hear a lot of the top rappers in America who are conscious from the hip-hop golden era is having a hard time getting into Africa when they used to get into Africa before, you know, when hip-hop was conscious, was having a hard time in some of these African countries.
Well, let me say, the sign of the fall of the Western world, this is why you read history, the fall of the Roman Empire, the fall of Egyptian civilization. Because what made these societies fall? Rome is a classic example. Rome began to fall because them were the moral fiber. Of the society. People were doing all kinds of things. This promotion of the homosexual culture is against what we believe in. Now, if you're a homosexual or an effeminate in the audience, you know, if you're a lesbian, I'm not talking about you or down on you.
Right.
But in the Bible and the Holy Quran, it condemns that behavior.